It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Andy's here. Alex is here. Jason's here. We're all here. And, of course, there's lots to talk about. Beeper Mini's back. The on-and-off-again saga continues. iOS 17.2 is out. Some big changes. We'll take a look at that new journal app. I'm pretty impressed. Also, changes to Apple TV, all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 899. Recorded Tuesday, December 12th, 2023. Which way to the bathrooms? This episode of Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by our friends at IT Pro TV, now called ACI Learning. Keep your IT team skills up with the speed of technology. Visit go.acilearning.com/twit. Twit listeners, your discounts could be up to 65% off an IT Pro Enterprise Solution Plan, but it depends on the size of your team. So fill out the form and find out how much you'll save at go.acilearning.com/twit. And by ExpressVPN. Protect your data and identity every time you go online with the number one rated VPN provider. Get their special holiday offer right now. 3 extra months of ExpressVPN for free with a 1-year package. Go to expressvpn.com/MacBreak to learn more. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest Apple news with our wonderful Apple friends. Hello, Apple friends. Andy Anatko from WJBH in Boston, wearing his Pixar cap, his traditional 12th yes. day of December Pixar cap.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you get an advent calendar of caps?
Actually, I did get a couple of advent calendars that I'm enjoying very much. It's nice to have this little, like, open little... We just never get over the idea of just enjoying opening a little compartment and not knowing what's going to be behind there, even if it's like a tiny little piece of chocolate. Yeah. If it's a little piece of Lego, it's Lego? Great.
Lego's a good one. I gave my son a hot sauce advent calendar a couple of years ago. Alex Lindsay, who probably has his own specially branded officehours.global advent calendar. Hello, Alex.
No, my mother sends one. We got chocolate. I think chocolate's I don't good. Know which chocolate, but yeah, we got chocolate.
Chocolate's yeah. always safe. Thank you. Welcome. And Jason Snell, who's in Studio B today.
Studio B, yeah. I'm in the back of the house today due to some technical difficulties in my garage. It's okay. Nothing's on fire.
Did it get flooded?
It's possible that my Mac Studio SSD may be on fire. I'm reinstalling, and we'll see what happens.
Oh,
but I'm back here instead.
Yikes. Well, I hope everything's okay.
It's much warmer in the house, quite honestly, so this is very
the
comfy.
Garage is chilly.
That's why Jason is such a professional, like top of the grade podcaster. He understands the concept of the ticking clock. It keeps people glued for the entire show. Will there be like smoke billowing from the left hand side of his frame? We don't know.
We never know.
Gonna have to sit and find out.
It's exciting. I got the reason why I'm got advent calendars on the mind. By the way, Gallifrey Rebel in our Discord says he wants the Prozac advent calendar. They don't make that because it would be the same thing every day, or maybe an increasing dose every day, which is probably not a good idea. But there is a pharmacological advent calendar, which has a variety of SSRIs in easy to consume form. Actually, this is the one you want. Somebody sent me unnamed. So whoever you are, thank you. The Whiskey Advent Calendar Explorers Edition, 25 drams. I'm gonna give this to. We'll do this with Richard Campbell tomorrow. I'll ask him to tell us what's in here. Maybe he sent it. I don't know. Anyway, happy holidays, everyone. This is episode 899. As Jason Snell, whose math is excellent, pointed out, next week, our last episode of the year on December 19th will be episode 900.
Amazing. You know, I can add, one to another and 900.
Your math's amazing. What's amazing to me is that way back when we started this show in, 2007, we planned it out so well that we would be, someday in 2007, the year 2024 sounded like sci-fi. And yet here we are.
The whatever government agency sponsored it has now unveiled the logo for the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, and I remember what it was like. I remember barely what it was like at the bicentennial in 1976, thinking that, oh my God, what? How old am I going to be in the 200? Wow, that's just
2026. It's going to be 20. Yeah. That's like 2 years from now.
It was hard to imagine.
I hope someone's planning the party already.
Yeah,
I hope someone booked the room for this.
Well, apparently the Library of Congress has planned our invitation to you celebrate America's 250th anniversary. They're getting ready already. They've got the deck right there. We call it the deck.
I hope we make it.
Hope we make it. You never know what'll happen in the next couple
Some
of years.
Some people call it a floor. I call it a deck.
Mm-hmm. Call it a deck.
I call it a deck.
So I think we're going to rename this show, at least for the next couple of weeks. This Week in Beeper Mini. the beeper's back.
Beeper Mini Weekly, right?
Yeah.
BMW.
Oh, I like it. Always wanted one of those. This is the return of Beeper Mini. And I found out, maybe the day before, because all of a sudden my Mac said, hey, another phone has joined you. And I went, what? That was the same thing I heard when I first signed up for Beeper Mini. So it just kind of automatically worked again. The workaround, it's only a matter of time before Apple puts the kibosh on it again. The workaround was apparently not doing the phone number, but doing your email login.
Apple.
Go ahead.
The beef was that, oh, well, Beeper Mini is falsifying a device ID and we can't have that, which is completely within Apple's purview. I don't think Apple has a responsibility to keep Beeper Mini working or to allow.
No, of course not.
Other devices on iMessage. But it's going to be fun that the fact that this was shut down so quickly meant that was something that was going to be very easy for Apple to shut down, like that trick. And what happens in the next 2 or 3 or 4 weeks or a couple of months to see as they grow, if they can shut down this version of it, which doesn't use falsified device IDs, can they make a version of this that works with just the email login? And then can Apple shut down non-Apple devices that are using the email login? And I think that where the rubber meets the road is 2 or 3 months from now, when it becomes both sides, here's how much work we're going to have to do to win this war, and is it worth it? But as I said, I was pretty excited about Beeper Mini last week because I love a good rhubarb. But as I said last week, this becomes a lot less relevant if Apple delivers on its promise to deliver RCS. If RCS arrives in iMessage and all Android users get most of what they would want from iMessage anyway, Beeper Mini kind of becomes irrelevant.
So this is we kind of nailed it last week. It had just come out the morning of last episode. Yeah. And I think we kind of nailed it where we said, you know, the question is, can Apple turn it off? And then the question is, how many people will adopt it? Apple clearly took it seriously because it became almost instantly the number one downloaded app in the Android mm-hmm. Play Store. So at least 100,000 people. Okay, that's getting serious. And then the question was, well, will Apple risk the regulatory heat if they block it? They were willing to. So they could, and they did. And they're getting the regulatory heat. Senator Elizabeth Warren wrote them a sternly worded email, or at least a tweet. I don't think she has a leg to stand on. Jason speculated that if Apple did turn it off, they would turn it off on the grounds of security. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. Here's Apple's statement from Nadine Haija, according to The Verge. At Apple, we build our products and services with industry-leading privacy and security technologies designed to give users control of their data and keep personal information safe. We took steps to protect our users by blocking techniques that exploit fake credentials. The fake credential in question is the phone number of your Android phone, right? And it made it look like an iPhone. In order to gain access to iMessage, these techniques pose significant risks to user security and privacy, including the potential for metadata exposure and enabling unwanted messages, spam, and phishing attacks. We'll continue to make updates in the future to protect our users. Now, some of that's not going to be the case if you're using a legitimate Apple account email, right? Because spammers, phishing attacks, are they going to create an Apple account? And even if they do, that's easy to turn it off quickly. So that's eliminated by this technique. Metadata exposure, I don't know. I guess so. I don't know. If that's being exposed, then it's exposed to everybody who uses messages, right?
I mean, I think Apple's just going to back into, you're saying you're something you're not. We're not going to let that happen.
And you're,
like,
you know, yeah.
I think that, like, it doesn't really matter what the little linkages and everything else talking. Like, if you're talking to Apple's building RCS, it's going to be a green bubble. It's going to say you're not in the Mac ecosystem, you know, and Apple's not going to, I don't think Apple's, I mean, I don't think, I think we can try to go through and check off all the little boxes. But the bottom line is that you are misrepresenting your device.
Well, one and other so thing.
Apple's just going to get into its, you know, that's where Apple's going to kind of draw the line, I think.
One other thing that probably pissed the hell out of Apple is they were charging $2 a month for it. Beeper has now said we're not going to, it's free because we can't really charge you for something that's up and down and up and down.
And it's never going to be up for very long. Like, you know, and I think it's more of Apple just making sure that people are clear, like, this is not going to be a place you can raise. You can't raise money against representing yourself as something that you're not. Don't go, if you're an investor, here's welcome to Apple. Like, that's what they really need, is to make sure that investors don't go, oh, this is a good business idea. Let's put $1 million into that. You know, and so just what happened over this last week kind of ensures that not Beeper may continue to flail around with this until RCS comes out, but they're never going to turn it into a business.
Yeah. Also, there was a report that the EU, one of the things that we were speculating about, or me too, last week, was about how maybe if it turns out that this is going to be a difficult thing for Apple to shut down, Apple might factor in that, okay, while we're arguing with the EU that iMessage is not a gatekeeper service and should not be subject to the Digital Markets Act, we can point to, oh, well, there's this third party tool, Beeper Mini, that, hey, we've decided to simply bless as an okay and acceptable thing. But there's a report that the EU hasn't made a decision, but that they've preliminarily decided that iMessage is not a gatekeeper service. So there goes another reason for this thing for Apple to not want to to commit acts of stern rectitude against the Beeper service.
What about Elizabeth Warren's contention? Senator Warren tweeted, "Green bubble texts are less secure." Which is an interesting thing to say. I'm sure Google wouldn't really appreciate that. So why would Apple block a new app allowing Android users to chat with iPhone users on iMessage? Big tech executives are protecting profits by squashing competitors. I don't really argue with that. Chatting between different platforms should be easy and secure. I completely agree with that.
And it is. There are many apps you can use to do it.
Yeah, in fact, Beeper Mini is just like using WhatsApp. It's not your default text messaging app. It isn't yet, anyway. They might make it that way. But for right now on an Android device, it's just like opening a different messaging app.
Yeah, but the question is that that's the default pre-installed, blessed by Apple messaging app is not nearly as secure as it can be. The fact that you can do this
is a problem, right?
I meant the fact that if you're not going iMessage to iMessage, then Apple really doesn't care about even the experience you have on the iPhone, which is another reason why, again, their supporting RCS makes a lot of problems go away. And as I've always held, I think it was just petulant of them not to incorporate a way to make messaging more secure on the iMessage platform. Unless you want to wave a magic wand and turn every single phone in the entire world into an iPhone, that was kind of a necessary step. So that's, I think, Elizabeth Warren is, of course, an antitrust hawk, which is one of the reasons why we love her so. But this
an irrational
is,
one, like an irrational, no, like.
Yeah, I mean, she makes a good point.
Her knee jerk is like, I'm going to attack everything that a corporation does. Like that's just kind of like that's sort of no, like, I will attack it all. I will attack it all. I will attack it all. It sometimes it makes sense. I mean, sometimes she hits the mark, but about 8 times out of 10, she does not.
It's like that's your opinion, Alex. That's your political point of view.
Sure,
but if any senator was going to basically say that shutting down a very hacky but wonderful way of participating in iMessage for Android, it was going to be Senator Warren. I will say that.
Yeah. Or Bernie. I don't think Bernie knows how to use an iPhone.
Go to one corporation, but to everybody.
But I will agree that I will say that Bernie usually hits the mark a lot more often than Elizabeth Warren. Yeah. Like he tends to be a little bit more connected to reality. So yeah.
Daring Fireball, John Gruber weighing in on this one, saying good on them. you know, that making it free. It was irresponsible to charge a subscription fee for a service they can't guarantee. Making it free should only help its popularity, but I think it's an open question, Gruber writes, how much demand there is for this. Well, we know now, in fact, is one of the most downloaded apps on Android, so there's demand. What's interesting is, and I think that there's some confusion, I'm not sure, Gruber says Beeper Cloud was relying on Mac Relay servers prior to October, and I thought that was the case too, but Beeper has now said, no, we're actually running on Linux servers in the cloud using this technique, the Beeper Mini.
Well, since October.
Oh, maybe that's the thing, yeah. Is they changed it in October, yeah.
Yeah, they phrased it to make it sound like it was there forever, but it's right. Since their October update.
Okay, so that, yeah, so that's part, okay, that makes sense. So, in fact, if Apple somehow finds a way to discontinue Beeper Mini, it would also affect the Beeper Cloud service, I guess. I find it hard to recommend giving your Apple credentials to any third party, period. But yeah, you're not doing that with Beeper Mini, right?
Right. Exactly. That's the difference. That's why it's more relevant, is that it's not one of these man in the middle trying to synthesize a thing, maybe using a Mac, maybe using some other techniques. Instead, it's it's running on your phone like it should. It's just emulating. Essentially, what happened is that 16-year-old kid reverse engineered the authentication method in order to get the right tokens in order to register and send messages back and forth. And the question last week is still the question this week, which is, you know, Beeper in their PR seemed to think like they had cracked it, right? Like they were going to be essentially undetectable because they were using Apple systems that iPhones use. And obviously the phone number thing, Apple was able to figure out a way to shut that down. And now we're in this game of cat and mouse. And the only, you know, the only thing that will determine how the game ends is really, and Apple knows the answer already, right? Which is, what methods are they using and what methods does Apple have at its disposal to change how it authenticates? And, you know, does it break old iPhones when it does that? Like, how much does it want to do here? But like, that's the part we don't know, is have they sussed out like everything Apple does for authentication? Or, and this is what I'm, where I'm leaning now, given what happened with the phone number authentication, they found a way, they think that's the way, and Apple knows that it's actually just one permutation of a larger scheme that they have, and they can move things around in order to break what may be a very brittle implementation on Beeper's part.
Right.
Yeah.
We just don't know, because we don't really know how it all works, because Apple doesn't reveal that. I suspect, I'm going to go out on a limb, I could be proven wrong in 5 minutes, but I suspect it's a little harder to block the email authentication. You're actually now logging in with your Apple account directly instead of registering a new number, a real Apple account. I think that might be harder to stop, but we'll see. It may not
be. And
we don't know.
I think the challenge is they have to detect a unique, I think every device that registers with iMessage has a unique ID, and the PR about this from Beeper suggested that you can basically generate a device ID, UDID. It's how all the Hackintoshes work, right? And that is one of those things that I thought,
if you could do a Hackintosh, doesn't that prove that what you could do what Beeper Mini's doing?
Only in the sense that it hasn't written to the level where Apple wanted to do something to deauthenticate it.
Right.
Like, I just wonder about that. But there are probably all sorts of little pitfalls that Beeper doesn't know about that Apple does. But then again, maybe not. I mean, you never know. Maybe they have kind of cracked the basics and Apple would have to invalidate, you know, a bunch of legitimate older iPhones, let's say, if they did this. I don't know.
Yeah.
But Apple could send something out to your older iPhone that says, "Hey, you have to do this update to continue to get messages or whatever." And it would be, it'd be inconvenient, but it doesn't sound like that Apple needed to do that in this case. And I think that Apple is most likely going to, you know, they're going to support RCS. They're going to do it to probably minimum viable product. Like they'll support it, but they're not going to put everything that they can do in iMessages into RCS. But once they support RCS, I have a feeling that what that also gives them the opportunity to do is be pretty much iron fisted with everything else. Like, it is going to be, hey, we're going to do RCS and you might be able to do SMS to go backwards or whatever. And we're going to do iMessages and nobody else gets to do anything. And these are going to be green bubbles and these are going to be blue bubbles. And, you know, and I think that, but look at all the cool, I expect a pretty big explosion of new features in iMessage at the next WWDC that will not be in RCS. Like, I think Apple will drive development of custom solutions in iMessage that, you know, because again, Apple is, they've got a hook on, you know, the 18 below market. And I have a feeling they would like to continue to expand that, because for either side, whatever you're in when you're in high school, the chances of you changing are probably less than 10% after you leave high school, you know, that you're going to move to another ecosystem. So I think that they're going to try to hang on to that.
Yeah. And if that's true, that's yet another indication that, gosh, nothing spurs innovation like competition and the threat of regulation. That's when they find that the time of the, when I say they, I mean everybody.
They've been doing it for a while. I mean, they put a lot into
But
I'm surprised. Like, my kids know so much about it. When they pick up my phone and do stuff with iMessages, I don't even know. I can barely keep track of what they're doing with their fingers. Like, it is, there's so much stuff going on. There's so many little features that Apple's added between all the different bits and pieces that don't really target us at all. It's really targeting an 18 below market. So they've been working on this for, you know, five to six years.
But again, like, that they're not adopting RCS because they just suddenly came to Jesus. It's because they saw a lot of reasons why, okay, it's now becoming more difficult to not support it than to support it.
Well, you also make a really good point, Andy, which is that Apple falls back to a very insecure protocol, SMS. And that's really not desirable. And Apple probably, regardless of the EU, adopting RCS makes a lot of sense, because instead of using SMS to text a non-iPhone, an inherently insecure protocol, I mean, just you don't have to trust me on this. Just look it up. It will fall back to RCS, which is a secure protocol, and you'll still have interoperability. So Apple should have done this no matter what the EU said. This is something Apple should do. If Apple says we stand for security and privacy, supporting RCS is a no-brainer. In fact, 100%. It surprises me they dug their heels in so much on this. So, and also Gruber says something important, which is that the iMessage protocol and the iMessage authentication, all that, is secure. Apple guarantees it. That's what Beeper's using. So Beeper isn't undermining that. What Beeper is adding to the mix is the fact that it's using an Android device. Gruber says, is Beeper Mini storing cached meshes content and attachments securely on device? Don't know. Is it transmitting privacy sensitive metadata back to Beeper with those analytics, which are on by default? Don't know. Beeper can and does vouch for the privacy and security of their client. In fact, in their latest blog post, they say, you know, we're going to offer this up to third-party security folks, and they can look at the source code so that we have that validation. So, you know, if they do that, then we'll know the protocol is secure. But Androids, as I've mentioned last week, are kind of inherently insecure. So, and as he says, as I wrote yesterday, the existence of an unauthorized client on a supposedly closed platform creates a genuine perception problem for Apple. If Apple can't control the clients permitted to connect to iMessage, it looks like they've lost control of the platform. And to some degree, they have lost control over the iMessage platform. And that's probably the strongest argument from Apple, internally at least, for Apple to fixing this, to stopping Beeper Mini, right? It should look like no one can do this. Is that right?
Yeah. And he also makes a good point that it's one thing to say, hey, well, it's using iMessage is communicating with this device exactly the same way that's communicating with any other iPhone. Therefore, this is as secure as communicating with iMessage on an iPhone. Well, no, because
it's not an iPhone.
That it's not, exactly right. What happens to the data once it's on the device? Is it in a secure place where a piece of malware can't find it? And if someone is trusting that an iMessage is secure from end to end, and that other end is kept secure, that is a super problem.
Beeper says, we deeply object. I object, sir, to the allegation that Beeper Mini poses significant risks to user security and privacy. This is completely untrue. As we explained above, the opposite is true. This I don't buy. Beeper Mini increases the security and privacy of both Android and iPhone customers. I guess to the extent that they're not using SMS to communicate, that's true. And so they are saying, we're willing to share the entire Beeper Mini code base with a mutually agreed upon third party security research firm. That's not going to happen, because Apple is never going to say, hey, Beeper Mini, let's mutually agree. They're not going to talk to them. They also say, which is interesting, if Apple insists we would consider adding a pager emoji to metadata on all messages sent via Beeper Mini. That would make it easy for messages apps to filter out messages from Beeper Mini users. That's an interesting concession.
I guess if Apple cares, like you're making a concession, you're asking Apple to make a concession when they've got nothing to,
they're not going to even talk to them.
Like it just, yeah. Apple's not even responding to their calls or their emails. It's, and it was like, hey, why don't we turn this off? Click. Okay. Now, okay. Let's go back to our regular.
But again, I'd be very curious. I mean, it's only been a day, but let's see if Apple can turn it off. I wonder if there, maybe it's a little harder to do that with just an email login. The phone number, maybe, you know, you can say, is this an iPhone? No, that phone number is not an iPhone. But can you say, I mean, it's a legit account now.
Although I mean, it could take them a little longer, but any incursion, it improves security. So they're going to make an incursion. It's not going to make that much of a difference. And Apple will build something over, you know, between now and June that will make it impervious. And all the things that they did to do this will be, you know, all those windows will be covered with concrete by the time we get to the next OS.
It's fun to watch. We will have more next week in the saga, I'm sure, of Beeper Mini. But we have lots of other stuff to talk about. Bloomberg, Mark Gurman, has ideas about what Apple's going to do next year. We have received iOS and 17.2 and Mac OS update and a TV OS update. We will talk about that. The new Journal app is here. All of that coming up in just a little bit with Jason Snell, Andy Iannocco, and Alex Lindsay. MacBreak Weekly is on the air, as it is every Tuesday. Our show today brought to you by our friends at IT Pro TV. And you may say, well, wait a minute, it says ACI Learning on all the signage in the studio because they're our studio naming sponsor, and on the lower third. Well, that's right. IT Pro TV has merged with ACI Learning, which makes it even better. Now ACI Learning covers all your audit, your cybersecurity, and your IT training needs. Of course, IT Pro TV is known and loved by our entire family. As part of the ACI Learning family, IT Pro has expanded its capabilities, giving it more for your IT team. All its courses, of course, are current and up to date, covering everything from Microsoft Cloud, AWS, to CompTIA, and on and on and on. If you have an IT team, you know, we talk a lot about individual training with IT Pro and ACI Learning, but if you have an IT team, ACI Learning is great for them too, because your team needs to keep up to date, right? They need to keep on top of all the changing things in the software tools they use, in the technologies, in the attacks they're prepared for. As part of ACI Learning, IT Pro has kept all the fun and personality, but amplified their robust solutions for all your training needs. Now, 7,200 hours of short form, easy to consume, entertaining content. And because all of their teachers are pros in the field, so they're experts, but they also have a passion for what they're doing. And that passion, that enthusiasm really communicates. So you're learning, and you're learning in a way that's fun and exciting. And that makes it automatically better than anything else out there. That's why their completion rate is 50% higher than the competition. You asked, ACI is delivered just in time to wrap up your annual CPE. ACI is re-releasing their entire audit catalog. This is something that ACI Learning has brought to the table in shorter, easier to digest versions. That means your CPE exams for each course will now be faster, too. Check out their new audit courses and lab releases. Certified Information Systems Auditor, CompTIA's Security Plus, is updated. You can also get the full scoop on how ACI can help you navigate the audit world. Go to acilearning.com/blog to read more. IT Pro TV, now part of ACI Learning, keeps your business from risking redundancy via the most up-to-date certifications and courses out there. It provides you with a personal account manager, so you know you're not wasting anybody's time. Your account manager works with you to make sure your team focuses on the skills that matter to your organization. You can leave behind redundant or unnecessary training. And, of course, everything is ISO certified, so you're getting the world-class training your team deserves. Keep your IT team up with the speed of technology. Visit go.acilearning.com/twit. As a Twit listener, discounts are amazing. You're going to get a free trial and up to 65% off. 65% off an IT Pro Enterprise Solution Plan. The discount depends, of course, on the size of your team. So fill out the form. Find out how much you'll save at go.acilearning.com/twit. Twitter. Thank them so much for supporting us all year long. Studio sponsors and a great team over there. We've been best buddies with the great folks over at ACI and IT Pro. All right. It feels like Mark Gurman has been doing more speculating and less rumor breaking of late. Remember last week where he basically speculated that Goldman would give up its, Apple Card stuff to Capital One or Chase? To Chase. And it was, Chase. But it was pure speculation, right?
Yeah.
It was just, I have a good idea. Well, now I'm wondering about this article. Apple readies new iPads and M3 MacBook Air to combat sales slump.
Oh, come on.
Well, you guess you knew it was going to happen, right? I mean,
well, I love Mark Gurman because I like his sources, but since he's been at Bloomberg, because Bloomberg fancies itself a market mover and a important business journalism site. What gets inserted into Gurman's articles are lots of narratives that are just completely BS.
Fantasy. Yeah.
And so in this case, it's like, the way that the story is written, and again, I don't think it's Mark. I think it's the culture at Bloomberg and the editors at Bloomberg. Essentially, it's framed as if, oh, geez, guys, we didn't sell enough iPads. Somebody whip up a new iPad for next month. Somebody whip up a new MacBook Air because Mac sales are flagging a little bit. And the fact is, the stuff they're going to come out with in March or around March, according to Mark Gurman, which again, I believe he has good sources, that stuff's been in the works for years.
Yes.
So they're trying to set up this bizarre narrative of like, oh, because A, then B, when in fact it's like, well, A is a thing and B is a thing that's been going on, and they're not really connected except in your fantasy world of your Bloomberg article.
And also, if you are looking at Apple's when they do market their forecasts, Apple not only is 2 or 3 years out when they're doing those, but they're making calculations of how many they're going to sell based on what they're releasing a year ago. Like they made the yeah. guess, and they're at looking least. At it. So they're not reacting to anything. They are going, well, we're going to have this is how many iPads we'll probably sell, and this is how many Macs, and maybe they'll get surprised a little bit, but it's plus or minus like 10%, 10%, not like, oh, suddenly it fell through the roof. I mean, that happened around COVID, but outside of that, Apple, it's, again, it's a much more slow moving ship, as Jason said, than what a lot of press seems to think, or some press seem to think it moves at.
But that's, I mean, that is since he didn't used to do that at 9 to 5 Mac, right? And Bloomberg insists on a level of storytelling and narrative building that Mark is now a part of, but he doesn't change that he's a great reporter who's got the best sources on Apple, I think, in the world. And I believe him, and he's right almost all the time. And when he's wrong, he's usually wrong because Apple changed its mind after the people who knew and talked to him. So I, in general, yeah, it's great. We're talking about new stuff coming in March, plus Vision Pro, which he says they'd like to get done before March or by March, which it's like, well, that's interesting because that before March sounds like February to me. But I mean, that's just, again, so good at math, let me tell you.
You're
so
impressive. Good. Yes.
Man, whoo.
I mean, there is some stuff, according to people familiar with the plans. The iPad and accessories are expected to launch around the end of March, alongside iPadOS 17.4. I'm going to assume that he has some information because he's actually talking about model numbers.
Oh, yeah.
The company's iPad. One of the things he said, and again, I don't know if this is Apple him or him speaking, is that they're going to kind of rationalize the iPad lineup. And that is the case. It is a little bit, there's overlap. Like, is the Air and the Pro, they're so close and so forth.
Sure feels like what they're going to do is they're going to make the Air be kind of like what the Air is now, mixed maybe with a little of what the Pro is now, and they're going to be the sizes of the current Pro models. And the way they're going to differentiate is, and I don't know how they're going to do it on price. I assume that if you have an 11 and a 13 inch, so they'll be slightly larger than the current models, iPad Pro, and it's OLED, I've got to think those are going to be a lot more expensive than the current models.
The OLED is what's going to cost you.
And,
Yeah.
And so it's an M3 instead of an M2. It's OLED screen, which is going to be gorgeous and has not been available. Even, I mean, there hasn't been OLED, but even the really nice screen has only been on the 12.9 the last two versions. It hasn't been on the smaller one, which is, I kind of assume, is more popular. I have the 12.9. It's great, but I assume most people probably opt for the slightly smaller model. And then they're going to throw in a brand new Magic Keyboard, which German talked about a few months ago, which is more laptop-like, and it has sort of a, you know, metal kind of stuff to make it feel a little bit more like a MacBook and not quite like what the current Magic Keyboard is, which presumably will be what the Air uses, and maybe even a new Apple Pencil on top of all of that. It sounds to me like you're going to be able to do a lot more and you're going to pay a lot more. But at least if you're worried about like confusion, this sort of like, do I get an Air? Do I get a Pro? What do I do? It's going to be a lot clearer because it's going to be like, wow, the Air costs this and the Pro costs what? And then you're going to make the decision about, but you know, if you watch movies in the dark all the time at home while your spouse is asleep, an OLED iPad's going to be pretty amazing, right? It might be worth it to you, or whatever else they roll in, or if that keyboard is really great, we'll have to see. But it sounds like they'll be really different.
It can't cost more than a MacBook Pro, though. Or could it? Or could it be the same price? I mean, they're really positioning it as a full-blown computer, right?
A full-blown iPad is $2,000 or more than $2,000.
And then you add the Magic Keyboard. Like yeah,
exactly. And, and it's OLED, right? I mean, an OLED screen.
You can't get an OLED MacBook Pro.
Yeah.
So maybe it, well, you think it'll be more. Wait a minute. Are you saying it might be more than a MacBook Pro?
Loaded,
maybe. Not the base models, no. Yeah. Exactly. Although then add in what's that Magic Keyboard going to cost? Yeah,
$350, $400.
My guess is if you want a 13-inch, and he says it's 13, not 12.9, 13-inch iPad Pro M3 with keyboard, is it going to cost around what a MacBook Pro costs? Somewhere in the $2,000 or a little bit below when you add all of that stuff in? Absolutely, it will. Well,
mine does now. Like it doesn't, if it went up at all, like the generally, I think I spent $2,100 or $2,200. It was totally loaded. I didn't buy the I didn't buy the last year's one because I was like, I've got a Pro one from 2 years ago that was like, I'm not going to keep on buying those every year. So I think that's the side of it. You're not updating as often, but these computers are already getting. I mean, and I will say that the iPads. I mean, the biggest problem is file management and, you know, a handful of other things that keeps me away. I'm always, when I open up my laptop when I'm on the road, because I always have my laptop and my iPad Pro, I'm always like, why am I opening up my laptop? But it's things like the audio interfaces and video interfaces when I'm jumping on Zoom remotely, the, you know, some of the file management, some of the things like that. Those are still things that I don't think the iPad does as well as the laptop.
Keep in mind the Magic Keyboard, the current Magic Keyboard, which Apple is going to replace with a nicer one on the Pro level, it's $350 for the 12.9 and $300 for the keyboard, right? This is a $350 accessory on top of a $1,000 plus accessory. So you're already, even at the base, if you consider them as a package deal, you're talking $1,400, $1,500. Yeah. And then they're going to do an OLED version. I feel like I'm very comfortable that if you wanted a 13-inch iPad Pro with Magic Keyboard come March, it's going to be about
$2,000. I would say $2,200, $2,500.
Why do people buy an iPad instead of a MacBook Pro? And I hear, whenever I write about the iPad positively, I hear from these people who are really angry because they're like, wow, you should just get a Mac then. And it's like, okay, Macs are available. There are no laws against buying Macs. The people who are buying the iPad Pro and the people who are buying that Magic Keyboard see value in using an iPad. It's a different platform with different advantages and disadvantages. And while I am not what I once was, which is desperately trying to get everything I do when I travel on an iPad, because I think Apple just doesn't want to let me do some of the stuff I want to do. And so I'll just travel with a MacBook Air and I'll be happy. But there are a lot of people for whom the iPad experience is the one that they want and they prefer it. And it's not I just want us to get out of the whole, like, well, why not just buy a laptop then? Because, you know, that's the point, is it's a different product. It's a different platform. And the best part about the iPad for me, the best part is you can't rip the screen off a MacBook Pro. Well, you can do it once. But after that, you can't put it back on and use it as a laptop. Whereas an iPad, you can use it as a laptop. You can pull it off and now it's just a pure tablet. And then you can put it back and use it as a laptop again. And no Mac can do that, at least so far. And for some people, there's huge value in that flexibility.
Yeah. And also, that's old-fashioned thinking. At its intro, the iPad was definitely something not other than a MacBook. It was something less than a MacBook. And now that's absolutely not the case. I wouldn't be terribly surprised to see Apple decide to try to see what a super premium iPad will do, because it is not something less than it. Now it's simply something other than. A creative person wants an iPad. It's the number of artists that I know that they would have been putting $2,000 into a digitizer tablet, or excuse me, a Wacom tablet, are now like, no, I've got an iPad Pro and an Apple Pencil, and the entire creative community is now standardizing behind, hey, here's a set of pencils that will work with Procreate. Hey, here's a certain set of templates that will work with this other iPad app. It's a device that, once it gets to the device to the level of it's an expense that helps me to make more money, that's when these kind of possibilities are created. And I think that's what we're seeing right now.
Do you think Apple's really doubling down on this notion that the iPad is a computer? And is there a group of people, they're not my generation, maybe it's the youngins, who want to use an iPad as instead of a laptop? That seems like Apple's now really doubling down on that fork in the road.
Well, it really feels like when I look at behaviors just in the airport, like if I'm sitting in the airport, under 20 and over 65 or 70, it's all iPads. It feels like it's
old
all
folks
iPads
like or, the iPads too.
But the, you know, cause it's just less things to worry about, less things to, you know, and you don't have to figure those things out. But you know, there's a lot of us that just have some, you know, I would, you know, say technological debt.
Is it fair to say
that we just know how to use it a certain way?
Or is it fair to say that people who have work to do are going to use a computer?
I do a lot of work.
It depends on what the work is.
Yeah, exactly. Because there's, I think that, again, when I get into like file management and I get into, there's just a lot of interfaces and things that I have to do that I find difficult to do on the iPad. I find myself back to my laptop, but on a trip, I will spend 80% of the time on my iPad. And then I'll pull out my laptop when I need to do those other things, because the iPad is a much better experience. Like overall, it's just, you know, I'm playing things and doing things and drawing on things, and I like it a lot more. And then there are those things that I need my laptop for. So I still have the two of them stuffed together in my backpack, but I want to use my iPad all the time. I just can't. Like I just get to a point where I'm like, oh, there's a ceiling here, and I still have like this little 13 or 14 inch whatever that I open up and dislike. I actually don't like using it, but it has things that I can't do on the iPad.
I would say
the new OS has me wanting to use the iPad more, because now I have access to web, you know, the cameras, and I can now just put breakout boxes on it. I can do all those other things. And so it's moving that direction. It's just not there yet.
Jason, like, you edit podcasts. You edit podcasts on it.
It is my favorite platform for editing audio, because the app is good. I'm using Ferrite Recording Studio, which is an amazing piece of software. And I use it with the Apple Pencil. And so I can actually sort of like cut audio and move it around just with my hand using the Apple Pencil. You can use it with that keyboard. You can use it with trackpad. You can use it with just your fingers. But I use the pencil and it speeds me along and I love it. And that's the thing. It's just the problem that we have all kind of learned now is that with the Mac, it was built open, and then a lot of people pile on with other features that you might not, you know, most people don't want, but you want, and you can get them that way. And with the iPad, it's born closed. And if you want a feature, Apple has to basically turn it on and prioritize it and build it. And if they haven't done that, like as a podcaster, the audio subsystem in the iPad is just substandard and Apple hasn't updated it. You can't run Audio Hijack. You can't record one app from another. You can't do any of that stuff. And is that esoteric? It is, but it's mission critical for me. And so I do reach a point where I can't use the iPad and I run into one of those brick walls that Alex was talking about. But for some stuff, like I would much rather edit a podcast on an iPad than on a Mac. And that's bizarre, because I've been using Logic for 10 years. Yeah. And yet, I'll tell you, it is kind of magic. My edits are better, in fact, than the iPad, because they're more precise, because I'm actually seeing the waveforms and just using the pencil to dice them out and slide them around. It's pretty great. Can I share you my – I got a wacky theory about the iPad Pro I want to throw out there. I don't think think this is going to happen, but I want to be on the record in case it happens, because then we can call, but we can play back without this disclaimer. Exactly. Don't play this disclaimer from the future. Play the next part that I'm about to say, which is, what if the M3 iPad Pro with that fancy MacBook-like keyboard ran macOS in a virtual machine?
Whoa, dude.
Wouldn't that be a reason to buy an iPad Pro? An
Only OLED if you iPad used Pro? iPad more, but you wanted occasional Mac support.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I don't even know if it would be. I mean, like, I would dump my laptop.
It's never going to happen. You're nuts. You're
never going to happen.
You're
no.
crazy. That ain't going to happen.
It could.
I do know photographers are another group where a lot of them, I'm even tempted because of the better screen, and certainly would be with an OLED screen, to use the iPad for photo editing. And the tools are out there now to do a pretty good job with that. Not quite the same. But there's things, I mean, I'm never going to be able to run Emacs on an iPad. Even if I could, I don't think I'd want to.
Well, there are environments that you can run. They're just not on the, like, oh, you can get,
I can run terminal. No, I can run Blink, which is an excellent terminal, and log into Emacs on my server.
Or you can run an entire Unix instance in an app on the iPad.
Right.
What you can't do is get access to the iPad's command line and run things there. So, yeah, I've done like Python development in an environment on the iPad, and you could do it, but it's like you're not really in the iPad, right? You're in the emulator or the environment app that's running in its own little sandbox. So you can do a lot, but like if what you really want to do is control the system, you can't. You just can't.
But it's like, so in that respect, it's a terminal. It's like a dumb terminal. I use a Blink shell. It's an excellent shell on the iPad. And then, but I have a server running somewhere that I can, I can run the other stuff. Well, through the shell.
That has been the solution to a lot of my iPad brick wall problems, is that I can use Prompt, which is from Panic, which is another SSH app. It's very, very nice. And that'll get me to any of my command line based servers. And I use Screens from Edovia, which is a remote control server for a remote control app, VNC essentially, right? And I have a Mac server at home. So if I really, 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 really have to do something on a Mac and I'm somewhere else on an iPad, I can use Screens, connect to the Mac mini server that I run out of my house and do it there. It's a little silly to have to remote connect to a Mac to do something, but it works.
I'm surprised that Apple hasn't kind of blessed that kind of thing with OS level support, that this seems like as part of like the service bundle that I get, the ability to say, by the way, your iPad can connect back to your Mac wherever it is. Without, it used to be kind of easy. Now it's really super hard. And I don't know why the iPad doesn't simply have a, hey, by the way, if you've got a Mac, even if they want to sort of like kneecap it a little bit by saying, oh, it will not work with MacBooks because, hey, those things go to sleep and we don't want to like disrupt what's happening on your MacBook. However, if you've got like a Mac Mini, Mac Studio, anything that's a desktop Mac, it can wake up remotely, connect to it, and basically virtualize that inside your iPad. I don't know why it doesn't do that. That'd be a cool feature.
Actually, forget what Jason's talking about.
Forget.
Why put a virtual machine on there? Just put a And that sells more Macs, right? So I always have my Mac Studio running to do a variety of server tools. If I could just put that up on my iPad.
Sure. I mean, they just recently updated screen sharing on macOS Sonoma. And the reason they did that is probably primarily for Vision Pro.
Right.
But I did have the thought of like, why is screen sharing not on iPad OS, right? Like that would be a logical place to put it, and then you would have your ability to connect to a Mac, and they've already got kind of the back to my Mac kind of stuff where you can with your Apple ID you can find the other Macs that are on the network. The missing piece is that you have to add a third party app to connect to a Mac, because screen sharing isn't on iPad as an app, and it should be. It totally should be.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. I'm sorry, I have my gingerbread latte.
You got this.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I spent thousands on my M3 MacBook Pro, and I love it.
Yeah.
And I have my iPad Pro just sitting there. I use it to FaceTime my mom. That's about it.
It's fine. I mean, it's not. It's totally not for everybody.
Yeah,
I know people who are utterly devoted to their iPads.
I feel guilty.
People who are completely indifferent about them, and I have a bunch of my friends who were in on the sort of I'm going to get an iPad Pro and I'm going to use it as much as I can kind of 5 years ago, 7 years ago, and they a bunch of them have gone to the iPad Mini, where they basically just said, you know what, I'm just going to use the iPad for what it's great at, which is, you know, reading web pages and watching videos and scrolling through the web and doing RSS and reading books and stuff like that. And like, and they've sort of taken a step back. iPad is good at a bunch of different stuff and not all of it is pro level stuff. And I think a lot of people feel a little of that guilt you're feeling, Leo, which is like, but I'm not really using this to its full advantage. And that's why some of my friends have just said, you know what, I'm going to step off and I'm going to go over here to the Mini, which is super convenient and easy and fun, and not try to use it to do these completely bizarre professional level things. I'm just going to use it for what I want to. And there's nothing wrong with that either.
Yeah.
And I seamlessly go back and forth. Like when I create a presentation in Keynote, I am typically sitting in, I now realize there's a outline thing in Keynote that I use now all the time, but I used to do it in Notes. And so I'd sit there in Notes and I'd type away, you know, like these are all the slides I want. And then I go into the iPad and I draw. Then I go back to the computer and I build. Then I go back to the iPad and I present. You know, so I go back and forth because one happens to be better than the other at pure speed. And so I think that I don't, you know, for me, I haven't needed to. I find that the iPad is a more usable experience, but I jump back and forth, even in the same app, I jump back and forth constantly. And that's where iCloud works really well.
Yeah.
And on top of everything else, one of the things that got me to buy an iPad Pro when they moved to the M1 was that it is such a really great accessory to my desktop that when it's not being used as an iPad, it is an external display. It is a remote. It's a remote control unit. It is so many really, really cool things. So I do suspect that the reason why Apple doesn't facilitate like remote access like we're talking about is that I think that there's maybe a dogmatic shift in which they just don't want to confuse what an iPad is with what a MacBook is. They would much rather make sure that there's a division between the two and it's an artificial one. That's just my suspicion. I don't have any evidence of this, but they've always had sort of a darling effect on the iPad.
It's really interesting to see how many people have terminal solutions for the iPad. Our Discord's running wild with them. Here's some more. Here's one
for remote management.
Yeah. Aaron, Secure Shellfish, which has a great name.
Yeah, that's a really good app. It not only lets you connect to those servers remotely, but it will put files in the Files app.
Oh, nice.
On your remote server. Yeah.
I use Tmux on the server, so it says it has good Tmux support, which I look for. There's quite a few of them. Citrix Workspace app. I haven't tried Prompt. I'm going to try that. So that means there are people wanting to do this, obviously, if there are that many apps to do it. All right. Let's see. So, I mean, can we just summarize what the GER man is saying about
Mr. GER
in March?
Yeah,
are we going to do? We're going to see new iPad Airs.
iPad Pro and iPad Air,
four models
around March.
Yep.
The other ones, the update to the Mini and to the low end, will come later in the year.
Okay.
Those will come, and the accessories for the new iPad Pro, which will be a different size, so they'll use new accessories.
And it sounds like a really nice new pencil, third generation Apple Pencil, and a really nice new keyboard, which. You know,
exactly.
Yeah.
iPad is, part of being a flexible modular computer is that it's all about the accessories, right? The story is not told on the iPad unless you also have accessories to be part of the story. And then like MacBook Air, I think this is going to be really exciting. We're going to get that M3 MacBook Air, he says. So sooner rather than later. I think that's great. He says Mac Studio and Mac Pro may not come until the end of the year or maybe even 2025, which makes me a little bit sad. But the MacBook Air is the most important Mac because it's the best selling Mac.
Right.
And my question.
There will be, he says, a new low end iPad, but that won't be till later in the year.
Right. The low end iPad, and they'll kick off the home screen iPad, and they'll just have the 10th and 11th, presumably, versions available. But that's later in the year. MacBook Air, my question though is, if there's an M3 MacBook Air, do they keep selling the M2 Air and kill the M1, or do they keep selling the M1 because it's cheap and just kill the M2 because it would look identical to the M3? And I'm warming to the idea that maybe it's the M2 Air that disappears when the M3 Air arrives. I don't know.
Okay.
Right? It's Tim Cook, right? It's Tim Cook. He's maximizing revenue.
I think somebody like Steve Jobs has to come in and just slash the product line and really rationalize it. It's just too crazy. Too crazy.
I mean, I think all the product lines feel like they keep on getting busier and busier and busier.
Yeah, nothing gets smaller.
It still feels like the 90s. I know that they're maximizing it, but at some point you're creating some... Well,
it's not like the 90s in the sense that there aren't a bunch of new products. It's that they keep the old products around to hit those lower price points. And, you know, I get it, but I think that there is, like, I don't want to see an M3, an M2, and an M1 MacBook Air on sale. I actually think that the M1 staying and the M2 going when the M3 arrives is more rational because the M1 and the M2 or M3 look very different. They have different functionality. And then there's a big price spread between them, and that's okay. The problem is that Apple wants to make really nice computers and they can't always hit those cheapest price points, and so instead you have an old one that you keep around, and that's the Tim Cook magic. But that's how, also, like on Amazon on Black Friday, you could buy a MacBook Air M1 for $799. It's, you know, not bad.
All
right, let's take a break, and then I do want to talk about iOS tvOS 17.2, the journal app, and the things they didn't ship in this latest updates all around. There was a new Mac update, too. I don't know. Is that to tie into the iOS update or just to fix security bugs? Oh, and then we should probably talk more about Vision Pro scheduling. Because clearly Apple's going to want to separate the iPad and the Vision Pro. I think it's crazy that Mark thinks February or January. But they did say early 2024.
Yeah, so, yeah. He was saying that they've been targeting January all along.
Yeah.
But that they were slipping a little bit. And that, but he said as soon, you know, sooner than March or as soon as March or as late as March. It's one of these things that it's not quite there.
They haven't decided themselves, no doubt.
But they're trying for January, and if it's February, maybe. But it's like it's right around the corner.
And
now,
again, it may not be 200,000 a week. It's just they want to get some of these past the, you know, into the open where people can. Right now, it's like you have to give blood and so on and so forth to get in to see them. So
number one reason it's not imminent, and this is in that same Mark Gurman report, is that Apple is actually bringing in a person from every retail store to Cupertino, and they're doing it mid-January for, and so a representative from every store, it's like Model UN, and they come in and they get a 2-day session that is the boot camp of how you sell Vision Pro in the Apple store. And then you send them back to their stores where they disseminate that information. And if they're doing that training in mid-January, you know, it's not launching in mid-January. It's launching in either very late January or sometime in February. But I would, you know, if you had February in the pool, I think you're feeling pretty good. I'd put some more money down on February right now.
The real question is, who's going to buy it? Are you going to buy it, Jason? You have to probably, huh?
If I'm not supplied a review unit, I will absolutely buy it because it's my job to do it. But I think there are going to be a lot of explorers, a lot of developers, a lot of people who are curious, and they're going to make so few of them that's probably going to satisfy
that. $3,500 could also buy me an OLED iPad the next month. See, it's tough. It's
one
tough.
And a half of those. Yeah.
Well, it's a good example of I'm not buying the new iPad specifically because I'm expecting to buy the Vision, so I'm not going to buy anything in the spring because I'm assuming that $3,500, once I put my prescription in, once I do all the other things, you know, I've got $5,000, sitting in a box, you know, to say that's what it's going to cost me to, $4,500 to $5,000 once the dust settles, because I'll get the extra battery pack and the extra thing and all those things will add up.
Good. I'm going to let you buy it because I really don't want to buy it. I really don't.
I'll bring it into the studio and you can laugh at me.
Awesome. There you go. We've solved it. Jason Snell and Alex Lindsay will buy that dopey thing and the face sucker. You'll let me put the face sucker on once just to reassure myself that I am not wrong, that this is a product category that has zero runway. Okay.
Only if you ask really nice, but yeah.
I really, no, Jason, I honestly
you,
think
you never come out to visit me. You should, you know, you're, my home has welcomed you.
I honestly think in
Massachusetts, I'll use it on the plane and then I'll see it and I'll come down to Rhode Island and I'll say hi.
I'm sure it happens.
Recharge it in the Uber, please.
I'm sure it happens that a company, because these things, plans have to be made so far out, throws the dart and misses, and they say we're going all in on VR. And it turns out AI was the thing, not mixed reality.
I just think that we won't know for another decade. Like, yeah. you know, I think Apple's going to do this for a decade.
I think we'll know. I hate to tell you. I think we'll know in January or February.
Well,
I don't think so, because I think it's going to be a remarkable cutting edge product. And everybody's reaction is going to be, well, it's amazing. But, and then we're going to spend like a year scratching our heads about what that means.
Right.
I don't think it's going to be a flop, right? I think that they've spent so much money on it. It's going to be an amazing piece of hardware. Having worn it for 30 minutes, like it is, this is what I said, I think last week, which is like, it's one of the world's richest companies spending all of their effort for 7 years on developing the most cutting edge piece of hardware they maybe have ever released. It's going to be really interesting technically. And then comes the waiting, right? Then comes the like, and now what happens? And
100%.
Who knows what that's going
to
be?
I'm happy to stipulate that it'll be amazing for 30 minutes. It's the 31st minute that is problematic for my
but that's fine. I mean, it will be a success because Apple gets to define what the word success means. And I really think they're smart enough to know that this is not going to become a blockbuster right away. This is going to be something where everybody who uses it, everybody who owns one, will say amazingly great things about it. But the normal people probably won't buy it for 3, 4, 5 years, 6 years. Like Alex says, I mean, they've got plenty of room. They just cleared $3 trillion of market cap. If there's one company that can basically say, we are willing to invest into making the first version of this hardware as perfect and state-of-the-art as it possibly can be, and then see how it goes from there, it's Apple.
And the problem is, because it's so hard, if they actually crack the code and they actually start going down the path and getting market share, it just becomes really hard for other people to compete with them, because they're playing a game that is really expensive game, like of what they're doing. So
this could be their iPad. I mean, just you look at the market for tablets right now, and really, it really is just the iPad. There's the Kindle Fire tablets, if you want to count that. But in terms of, here is a tablet computer that is inherently a tablet computer that's designed for productivity as well as anything else you can do for a tablet, it really is Apple and everybody else. And they could do something, they could pull something like that off here, where if you want to do augmented reality, virtual reality, the one that everybody's getting is this one. People who, for whatever reason, don't want to have the Vision Pro or the Vision series will get an Oculus, will get something else, will get something that's game oriented as opposed to productivity oriented. So there's, again, I love the unknowns about this, that it could be just about anything, including Apple saying that we've accomplished everything that we set out to accomplish with the Vision Pro series. And as we go into a new decade of the 21st century, we're ready to incorporate these into other product lines.
You know, Ferrari builds cars that are not street legal. And there are people who come along and spend $1 million and garage them, and that's that. Doesn't mean it's a product. I think this is a money pit, big time. And I guess Apple has them. I mean, look, Elon could waste $44 billion on Twitter. Apple could waste 10 times that.
This is way more productive than that.
Look how well that's turning out.
I don't think it is. I think it's a money pit. I think Apple's made a tactical error. Bravo for, you know, putting all that technology in there. That's cool. You could also, you know, you could build a Ferrari that nobody can drive, but doesn't mean it's a product. But that's just my opinion. We'll find out someday. I don't know if I'll still be alive. I will buy the ones that look just like spectacles. I will buy those. Yeah. Well, but that's not the same product. That's a whole different thing.
Yeah, I think that the issue is that you have to do this product before you do that product. Like you can't just turn that one on. So I think that that's the, you know, figuring out the model is part of the process. And so it's one of the advantages Meta has, is they've already done a bunch of that. Definitely figured out what didn't work and in some cases what worked. And so I think that Apple has, you know, I think that you have to get on the ground somewhere. And I think this is where they're getting on the ground.
Our show today brought to you by ExpressVPN this holiday season. As you're pounding down the advent calendar of whiskey or maybe some delicious turkey and gravy, I want you to think about everything you have looked at on your phone this last few days. Maybe you prefer not to. Every website, every link you've clicked on. Who's in charge of the Wi-Fi you've been using with all that content? Especially as you're out and about. And by the way, I should point out that your mobile carrier is also kind of keeping an eye on what you're doing. They have access to everything you've been looking at. Unless you do what I do and use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is the only VPN I recommend. Now, a VPN is clearly a great solution for keeping you private, keeping you secure, eliminating geographic restrictions when you want to watch that special holiday movie that's only available in New Delhi. But, by the way, Christmas and Bollywood, a mix made in heaven. There is a difference in VPNs, and that cheap or free VPN you're using is not going to protect your privacy. In fact, you're just giving them the information that you'd be giving to your carrier, and that's not better. That's why I use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN goes the extra mile to keep you safe, secure, and private. They develop the trusted server technology, so when you press that button on your ExpressVPN app on your phone or your tablet or your computer or your TV or even on your router, and it spins up that trusted server, it's doing it in RAM. It's sandboxed. It cannot write to the hard drive. And the minute you disconnect, it goes away. And so does every trace of your visit. That means your privacy is guaranteed. And that's been audited by independent third parties year after year. It really works. There was a great article in Bleeping Computer about how ExpressVPN works. They use a custom Debian distribution that wipes the drive every day when they reboot. I mean, they really take the effort. ExpressVPN encrypts all your online traffic to keep you private. Not incognito mode doesn't do that. It doesn't hide anything except, you know, your history from your wife or husband. If you don't have ExpressVPN turned on, you might as well just read your browsing history out loud to the whole family the next holiday feast. Hey, how'd you like to hear what I do? The same goes wherever you are, work, home, traveling. Work does it too, by the way. They spy on you, and they have every legal right to do so. If you've been using ExpressVPN, you know what security is. I've been using it for years now because I value my privacy. You should too. We have worked with ExpressVPN to get you a special holiday offer. You'll be glad to hear about this. ExpressVPN.com/MacBreak. 3 extra months of ExpressVPN for free when you get that 1-year package. ExpressVPN.com/MacBreak. ExpressVPN. The best way to protect your privacy is to stay secure and to watch Bollywood classics. ExpressVPN.com/MacBreak to learn more. That was, what, by the way, one of the highlights of my digital detox. We had a little dance off. There was a wonderful woman there who is from, I think, Toronto, but she was Indian and she taught us all Bollywood dance moves. And I think that everyone should be able to do that. That's always been a goal. Maybe the Vision Pro will help me with my Bollywood dance moves. See, there's something about the Vision Pro that I have the same problem with all VR things is I don't want to put something on my face.
That is a problem.
Yeah.
That'll do it.
Yeah, that'll do her. I love movies, by the way, and I've said this many times. A movie is a virtual reality experience. You go in there, the screen is big, fills your field of view. There's music carefully cultivated to give you an emotional reaction. There's fine acting on the screen. When you're in a good movie, well done, you're there. You're in the movie. That's VR, and I don't have to put it on my face. And I don't think it would be better, honestly, if it were on my face. I kind of like.
No, you just have to put up with the teenagers next, behind you.
That's why I built a home theater.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's not a home. It's not a dedicated room or anything. I don't want people to think I'm nuts. But we have a nice TV. I sit fairly close to it with good surround sound, and it's a great experience. And that is VR.
I mean, I think the content is really always the challenge. Like, what are you going to do with the content, and how are you going to make it viable? Because I think that's where Meta doesn't. You know, leaving it up to a lot of developers. I mean, Meta, paid Epic to do Robo Recall, which is the, in my opinion, probably one of the best examples of what you can do in VR as far as a game. And but there was that.
Oh, they're great games. And I love Beat Saber, you know, dancing to Lizzo. And oh, it's fun. After about half an hour, it's like, okay, I'm done. And my face is sweaty and it's got red marks. Or,
yep.
It just does not, I don't understand the aesthetic of it.
And, I'm going to try to get over it for the Apple, the Apple for the Vision. My biggest reason that I stopped using the headsets was because there wasn't a diopter. Like it was just, it was that I didn't really want to swap lenses in and out, right. And it's need to wear glasses
wearers,
you know, or my contacts. Yeah. And it was just literally that little, and the problem is that because the Samsung Gear came out and it had a diopter, even though it might not be quite as good as them, knowing that a diopter existed and they weren't putting it into the headset made me so frustrated that I just stopped using it. I was just like, I don't want to play this. And then the other thing was that with Oculus, before it was standalone, and how I got out of the habit was, every time Windows updated it, it would break the Oculus software.
Right.
And it was just like, update, now it doesn't work. And now I have to go and dig in to figure it out.
I have the Quest Pro sitting in my desk, and I don't... Yeah. I get an actual physical aversion to putting it on. And that's a problem for a consumer product.
It is. It just depends on, like, when I take the Quest to, like, the shore, when my extended family all goes to the shore... The only thing that stops kids from playing with it is battery life. Like it is, it just, they'll sit there and use it all day until.
But do your kids play with it?
They don't play with it as much because they haven't set it up any further. It's the whole login to the Meta thing that
I think also
because using it at that moment.
Yeah, they're
and then at that it. And then it just stopped. Yeah.
So I'll just say I get your skepticism, Leo. I totally do. I have a Quest 3 and I use it, and there comes a time where I can't play ping pong on the Quest 3 anymore because of my face, arg, right? But I will say this. You remember the early days of the personal computer. They were slow, they were big, they were ridiculous. What I think it's very interesting about
they
this
didn't
is...
They didn't nauseate me, Jason.
Yes, but they will get better screens, they will get smaller, they will get lighter. Now, will anybody want to use this kind of technology? Will people... decide they would rather use a computer by putting a screen on their face than in front of their face.
There absolutely will be.
We you know, that's going to be the mystery about like how this goes.
People scuba dive. They love to put a thing on their face and oxygen tanks on their back and dive into the water.
Right.
And the people who love it, right? You know, scuba divers.
All I'm saying is that this is cutting edge tech, but it is also early tech, and that if this category continues to be iterated on for 5 or 10 years, that headset is probably going to be a lot less heavy and unpleasant to wear than it is now, and it's going to be less laggy and it's going to be higher resolution. And Alex always talks about the resolution and frame rate required to really sort of like make your brain completely think it's reality. Like I can see that in 10 years we may have something that checks all those boxes if Apple can get from here to there. And that is still an open question.
Yeah. I mean, as long as Apple delivers something more than, again, I'm staring right now at a $300 screen that is beautiful and wonderful. If I wanted something nearly as good, it would cost me $200. If all Apple is offering me is, you know, that $200, $300 mini DisplayPort screen that works great for all of your productivity stuff. Imagine if a $3,500 thing you wear on your head, light or not, could actually make that into a fake screen. That's so long as the virtual screens who run iPad adjusted apps is just a first step before developers get in their hands and start developing apps that are emphatically virtual reality, emphatically augmented reality. It's still an infant product. Well, how fast can they spin that up?
I think one of the important things, though, is that one of the things that we saw, because I did a lot of R&D in the early Oculus days, we were testing a lot of things, and one of the things that we had a problem with is that people needed to be able to get to those productivity apps while they were at the headset, or they keep on taking the headset off. So I got to check my email. I got to do these things. So the fact that those productivity things sit inside the platform is really important because it means that I can jump out of this or move this over to one side and check my email and I can do other things, and then I can go back to what I did.
You're not even having fun. You're working in these things.
No. But what I'm talking about is there were momentary needs to get to something that were causing people to take them off. Whereas if you had, you know, so, you know, like we built an interface where you watch golf, you watch the 16x9 golf in front of you. You turn to one side, you get all the data. You turn to the other side, you get all your like Twitter and other notifications and everything else. And so you would be able to, the idea though was creating larger, longer dwell time, you know, and I think that that was the, you know, that was a real challenge that we had, was that people felt like they, to get back to their email, to get back to other things, you know, that they would take them off, and then they take them off, they'd be less likely to put them back on again. You know, and so, or they'd lose their place or whatever. So being able to have these things all exist inside of the same location is going to be pretty interesting, I think.
Sure.
And I should point out that the worldwide, there are 6 million scuba divers, you know, which, I mean, scuba not only puts something on your face, but you can die. I mean, there are, it's a scary, dangerous thing, but there's still 6 million people worldwide who do it. I imagine there will be at least 6 million. There'll be at least 6 million people who will be willing to use a Vision Quest, a Vision Pro. I'm sure that there will be some market for it. I mean, if people will scuba dive, they'll do that. But I also know a lot of people who say, are you kidding? Put that on my back and dive underwater with the thing? And no, I'm never going to do that. And I'm in that group. I do snorkel. 11 million snorkelers in the U.S., 20 million worldwide. So I guess snorkeling's not that much different, right? Hey, what is the difference, I ask you, between Apple's App Store and Google's App Store? Well, according to the jury... There's a big difference. Epic, as you know, sued both Google and Apple over the App Store. Apple beat them in court, but a San Francisco jury yesterday ruled in favor of Epic and said that, in fact, the Google App Store acted unfairly as a monopoly. Big victory. Now, I guess this will be appealed for the next 100 years, but a big victory for Epic in court. Why did they win
Was the Apple one in front of judges, or was it in front of
the Apple judgment was in front of one judge. This was in front of a jury. So that's one factor. Another factor was that in this case, the Epic had a lot more receipts than Apple, than they had against Apple, where they were able to see that the work that Google had done to basically create what the prosecution would have called sweetheart deals with handset manufacturers to make it more, to lock out other app stores from Android, plus the internal documentation, internal messaging inside of Google saying, hey, look, this is a really big threat to us. We have to do everything. We have to do what we can to sort of tamp this down, because this is how much this will cost us if we allow third party app stores to get into the business. It was a full sweep. It was pretty much the opposite of the judgment against Apple. The jury basically agreed with every single one of Epic's complaints. And so next week, the judge starts to decide like what punitive action might be taken. Epic didn't sue for any money. However, what they were suing for is basically an injunction, or basically an occupational order that they could force Google to make sure that they've got blessed. They could basically force Android to do something, Google to do something they don't want to do, which is to officially support third party app stores and do nothing to stop Epic, and also to shut down these exclusivity deals that basically say that if you're going to get the good stuff from Android, if you're going to get the Google Maps, if you want to get the YouTube app, you're going to have the Play Store, and you're going to have to lock out competing. You can't ship any of your phones with competing app stores either. So that could be a big problem.
The jury in under 4 hours decided that Google had engaged in anti-competitive conduct, harmed Epic, and illegally forced its own billing system on developers. Tim Sweeney, CEO at Epic, said, "The dominoes are going to start falling here. The end of 30% is in sight."
Yeah, spare me that guy. But I think the challenge here is, yes, he's very excited about not keeping that money for himself. That's what a jerk. But here's the thing. It is Google. I mean, the problem is the Apple ruling was very much like Apple is a monolith that has a black box, and it says, you want to be in the black box? Here's what the rules are. And the challenge with Google is like, no, we're open and we have partners and all of that. And I was like, well, the problem is then they were trying to exert essentially for the same reasons as Apple, exert control in order to take money out of the ecosystem. But the difference is for Google, it was starting from a position where it wasn't exerting that power and then entering into the exertion of that power and then doing things like, you know, working with different phone makers, as Andy said, to sort of squeeze them on things like, you've got to accept this if you want to have that. You got to take the, if you want apps, you got to take the in-app purchase rules. And then they also did a few things like approaching other developers and saying, why don't we invest in you so that you'll use our system, which the jury didn't, they weren't told that it had to be like a bribe, but there was it was an anti-competitive action.
It was a bunch of stuff like that. It's not a bribe. It's Project Hug.
Yeah, exactly right. It's not a bribe at all, but now you're our partner and you're going to do what we want. Isn't that great? Aren't we very happy? And then they also cut a bunch of like, secret deals, like the one with Spotify.
Doesn't Apple do that too? Don't we think Apple does the same thing with Amazon and Spotify? And
but so here's the, and what I should also say, the other thing that the jury had to decide on is, do you believe that Google's argument about why it charges 30% has no alternative explanation that is simpler? And they seem to not believe it. Although I think there are actually some explanations that you could have used, but they didn't take them. So yeah, I mean, Apple has done some of this stuff, but I think that the real difference is in presentation, where Apple sort of was upfront of like, we control it all, one in, and Google was sort of like, hey, we're expansive, but it'd be shame if something happened. And and it led down this path where this was, one, in front of a jury, and two, kind of a clearer case all around than the Apple stuff, which is a little bit harder to make. So I'm not convinced that all the dominoes are going to fall Tim Sweeney's way, but and this may yet be appealed out. But there's some interesting reasons why this way the way it did.
Yeah, and it's probably going to, I mean, it will probably, this is the beginning of a 3 to 5 year, travel to the Supreme Court. And so, you know, it's still got some time.
It's the last time a jury will have to weigh in. It's going to be judges all the way down now, right?
Yeah. After this is passed the jury. And, you know, I think the judges oftentimes are a little bit more stringent on what that means, what those requirements mean, because they just see them more often. And so a jury is going to be less, technical.
A jury votes from the heart. The judges vote from the brain.
It's true. But one of the key antitrust issues here, which is really interesting, is what I mentioned before, the idea that, and Andy mentioned it, that if you want to get the Play Store, so as a phone maker, if you want apps on your platform, you have to take the billing system that Google wants you to take. And that's called tying. And the idea there is, if the, you know, you have complete control over this, which is the distribution of Android apps functionally, even though we can argue there are lots of other ways to get things on and there are other app stores. But if you view that they're tying this to this other thing in order to make money, it hits the antitrust bell, right? Like the siren goes off then. And the jury looked at this and they said, yeah, the siren goes off. And it is an example where Google, I mean, there's no doubt Google is using its clout as the owner of the Play Store to get everybody to use their in-app purchase system. Now, is that any different from Apple? Only in the sense, again, I feel like that Apple comes with its black box and says, would you like to live inside our universe? And Google, because of the way they've structured Android, has a bunch of different partners and a bunch of different things, and has retroactively built some of this where they used to let you have more freedom, but now they don't let you have as much. And it was a harder argument to make.
Apple said, though they didn't respond to a request for comment, that's what they said. Google plans to,
they were hiding.
Google plans to appeal. This is according to Bloomberg. Apple has said in the past it doesn't have any side deals with developers, although we do offer discounted rates to some video streaming partners like Amazon. You know, Google, in a way, it's sad, got in trouble because they have an open, because Android's open source. You just said it. You know, they.
Yeah, it requires a lot more. There's just.
I admired them for doing that, but then they had. You know, if you want to have the Google Play Store and all of that, you've got to adhere to our. You know, and people who buy Android phones kind of want the Googly stuff on it. So,
yeah.
I mean, I kind of honor Google for saying, well, we're going to keep it open source. And you could, as a handset maker, you could use AOSP, the open source version of Android, without any of the Google products on it.
And that's no small thing,
I think.
Wait, that's, well,
But it is no small thing. I agree. That's a big deal that they
Amazon based Fire OS on Android. And there are a whole bunch of other projects all across the world that aren't even phone related that are based on the open source version of Android. So it's no small thing, but let's not kid ourselves that the ideal from like 2005 pre-iPhone that, oh no, we want to create a platform agnostic operating system that treats everybody. And then Google figured out that, developing all this software is really expensive. And it's also a huge opportunity that we're basically leaving money on the table. We will let you have the car with no air conditioning, the factory radio, the cloth seats. If you want the car that everybody wants, you're going to have to sign some deals with us.
And how do you feel about rolling up the windows by hand?
Exactly.
You know, it's funny. That's all cars had. But now if somebody has that in their car, it's like, what the hell? This is 18th century technology. Don't you have a button you can push? That was I'm old enough to remember when it was a big deal when power windows came into cars. That was like, ooh.
I just know that if I get in a rental car and I don't have a rear view camera, I'm like,
oh, I know. How do you back up?
What do I do here?
You mean I have to look?
How did I get here?
Oh, yeah, but exactly. I can't really turn that way.
I don't know how to do that anymore.
My neck doesn't go that way anymore.
It's also made road rage a lot harder to execute because back in the, again, I grew up in an age of power windows, but we still understood that if someone had just cut you off and you're next to each other at a red light, you can go basically saying, hey, idiot, hold on your window so I can yell at you now.
That's right.
What do they do now?
Yeah, push. That's a good point. What is the gesture for open your window?
Oh, well.
Tap, tap, tap. iOS 17.2, tvOS 17.2 have arrived. As usual, there's security updates, but the biggest thing you'll notice almost right away is there's a new app on your phone called Journal, which I like. I love the prompts. It knows my photo memories. Write about a person in your life you're grateful for as a reflection. It knows that I took an outdoor walk. Wait a minute, let me get out of here. I don't want to actually do that right now. It knows that I took a walk, that I called my sister on her birthday, that I visited my dad. It knows my favorite album. I mean, that's cool. Now, the folks at Day One apparently were consulted on this. I'm very happy to hear. Day One, which is a long time, very good paid journaling app, which I've used for years, and now owned by Automattic, the WordPress folks, which are good people to hold on to it. Apparently, Apple actually talked to them instead of just Sherlocking them. And Day One says that because it's an API, we're going to have those prompts and so forth. We're going to do all the same things. So that's good if you want powerful tool. But I love Journal. I'm very impressed. I did not think I would like it as much as I do.
It's meant to be the journaling app for the rest of us, right? The idea is you start with this. It's an Apple default, so you start with it. And then you may discover that you want more, and there are lots of other apps that are more complex and better than this and cross-platform and all sorts of other things. But the way they built it is the right way because they built it on a journaling suggestions API. So instead of saying, well, the only app on the whole platform that knows what you did and where you went and what you listened to and what photos you took is ours, and that's why you have to use ours, they built an API. So they built their app because it does compete with other journaling apps, and it will that's it's true, but that what they didn't do is lock all the other journaling apps out from that data. It's all there in the API. Woo-hoo. And contributing to the API, it's not comprehensive, right? There are certain kinds of APIs you have to use for your apps to contribute information to that. So I don't think it knows what Spotify music you listen to, right? But it knows what Apple Music you listen to. But they may be able to extend that over time. But in general, I feel like this is the model for what new Apple app should be, which is it is not built on proprietary, hidden, only Apple can access data. It's built on an API that is part of the platform that all other apps can also access. That's a good thing.
Now, you wrote a good piece on it, by the way, Rich.
Dan Morin, not me.
Oh, not you, Dan. He says it offers introspection surface deep. He says he's often tried to start a journal, as have I, and I know probably most of you, and failed many, many times. What is his complaint about it?
I think it's the same thing, which is it is basic and it is
He says it's a clever idea and one that's clearly meant to ease people into the habit of journaling by answering the age-old question, what do I write about? But I'm not convinced it's enough.
Yeah, I think it's my good, first journal. Actually. And it's a starting point, right? I mean, this is 1.0. What I hope will happen is what has happened with a lot of other good Apple apps like Notes and Reminders, which is over time, based on how people are using it, they will update it. But it is really the idea there is the thought, and this is part of their kind of mental health focus. It's the thought that being a little mindful, thinking at the end of the day about like, what did I do today or what am I grateful for? And it is a gratitude journal kind of thing,
which is nice.
Here,
that's really valuable.
That improves your mental health
thing.
Because you are, instead of just letting it all pass you by, you are dwelling
Thank
on it
you.
For a moment.
Yes.
And that may be all that's required. And you may not even need to look at it later. You may just need the act of thinking in order to reinforce those things in your mind. And it'll, you know, that's what it's there for, but it is also just a fairly basic thing, but it's a good thing to have, I think, on an iPhone. I'm sad that it's not on the iPad and the Mac. It's only on the iPhone right now, but that'll change eventually.
You can use it on the iPad, but it's an Apple. It's an iPhone app, not an iPad.
Yeah, it's
app.
An iPhone app.
They should really make it an iPad app, or use Day One, because it's all of the above, and it's really great. It even works on Windows if you're crazy. His chief complaint is exactly the reason I love it. He says it's a social network for one. I found myself struck by the solitude of the journal app. Well, yeah. And honestly, I think that's, to me, that's its chief value is you can, you and actually the, maybe he'll learn if he does it for a while that the audience isn't you today. It's you in the future.
Yeah. I don't think he's criticizing Apple. I think he's skeptical about whether Journal. Our current society, which is so focused on taking a picture of your salad and putting it on the internet, is going to be able to adapt to the idea that maybe you should just write about your salad for yourself and not tell everybody else about it.
Which I'm a big fan of.
Yeah.
I have to say, though, you know, and again, this goes back to that retreat I did. I had never written anything, you know, my hand is like a claw because I don't do handwriting anymore, but I was forced to, because there's no technology, to handwrite and write a lot in that week. And I got used to it. My handwriting got better and I started to enjoy it. And I think there is something to be said for handwriting a journal. There is something in the process, the physical process of writing on a page, that makes a journal more valuable. I don't find, you know, typing on a phone screen to be quite as self-expressive, maybe, as doing it by hand. But on the other hand, you can put in the music you listen to. You could put in the pictures. I went to visit my dad yesterday. I put pictures of my dad in there. So there are some pros and cons. Maybe do both. I don't know. But I think handwriting is really powerful to me.
The great thing about writing on paper is that it will be human readable unless there's a fire or a flood.
Well, that's the funny thing, because I mean, if I do it in day one, it's backed up in their servers. It'll probably outlast anything I handwrite, and I can search. Plus, day one pulls up, here's what you did a week ago, a year ago. You know, you can and so forth.
I don't know if I could write a whole page anymore.
Yeah, but that's what I thought too. And you get better at those muscles come back quick.
I've done that. I had to write something recently. I had to fill out a form at the doctor's office. And by the end, I was like, man, my hand hurts. I have not used those muscles in a long time to do more than like a signature or like put something in, because I just type everything. Like I don't, you know, my thumbs are much better.
Neal Stephenson, who writes, as you know, very long novels.
Yeah.
Writes them in pen. In fact, if you go to the Museum of Popular Culture in Seattle, there's one of his, I think it's Snow Crash. There's literally a human sized pile of papers and boxes of Pilot fountain pens. Yeah, that was the short one where he hand wrote. The Baroque cycle was all handwritten. There's something about handwriting that I get now and I support. But nevertheless, for a lot of people, having just this. And those gratitude prompts are good. I think it's really good. Let me see if I have a prompt for today in my journal. Let's see. Select a moment and write journaling suggestions. So it mentions my wife, highlights from photo memories. Here's the reflection. Describe someone in your life who you really appreciate but forget to thank. See, I think that's a nice thing to slow down and do that. Here it's got an outdoor walk I took. So I can talk about that. Other photo memories, music I listen to. Here's another prompt. Who's the most creative person you know? record a voice memo with a compliment for them. Obviously, they had mental health professionals working with them on this, because I think it's quite good.
For sure.
Yeah. I went to the barber shop this morning, and it actually knows that. And now I could write a little thing about my visit to the barber shop if I wanted to. I think that's great. I like what they've done here. I don't, by the way, yet see all of that in day one. I don't know how much of the API they're using, but it's good.
Oh, and we should say one of the things about the API that's very clever is privacy related, because it's Apple, which is
right.
When you do it as an API, what that means is you might think, oh, no, day one now knows all this personal data that I don't choose to share. But that it works like sharing photos does now with an app, which is the app calls the sharing API for suggestions, the journaling suggestions API. And then you see a window with a bunch of things that are suggested, and you select something. And when you select something and say, put this in day one or the journaling app, that data is then given to the app, but the app doesn't see it before then. It's completely private. So any aggregation that Apple's background API is doing to collect information and intuit events in your life that you might want to write about, apps don't get to see that. You have to choose to share that with an app. And that is, again, the right way to build that feature. Yes. And Apple did it right.
Yes. So you see the list of stuff because you're on your device, but then
the app doesn't.
The app doesn't. But then you get to say, I do want to take that barbershop and put that in my journal. And then the app gets to see it.
Then the app gets it.
Brilliant.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. You know what? This is Apple does a lot of new. Remember Flow? Apple does a lot of new apps.
And iTunes.
Clips. Remember that one? No. Apple does a lot of new apps that don't really get traction. I hope this one does. I think this is a good idea. And you know what? Mm-hmm. Maybe put that salad in your journal and not on Instagram. Just a thought. Just a crazy thought. No, you, Andy, you can keep doing it because I like watching your diner pictures. What else is new in 17.2? That we should
The emoji sticker replies in messages is in there for one. That's a feature that I ranted about a while ago because they did it really badly, and it's slightly less bad now. They didn't make it tap backs, so you still have to go to a different interface. They're not using the tap back interface with the six emoji to let like everybody else who just lets you arbitrarily assign emoji. Instead, you tap and hold and say, give me a sticker, and all the emojis are stickers, so you can pick one. And the big change in the beta was when it first came out, the stickers covered the text of what you were responding to.
Oh, yeah, you didn't like that. Did they fix that?
What?
They did fix it.
Good. So now the first two reactions don't cover the text of a given message. And then the future ones after that, they do.
Maybe you should reconsider if you're putting more than two reactions on your text.
Emoji should just be built into tapbacks. That's what you should do. Right. Apple chose not to do it. I don't know why. It's not a very good feature that we were hoping for, but it's not super bad like it was when they first released it. So that's in there.
Spatial video. Recording.
Capture. Yeah. Have you used that yet, Alex? Have you done any?
I played with it. It's a little tricky. So it's 1080. You have to be in landscape mode, and you need enough light. Like you'll get. Every time I picked it up for the first couple times, it was like, hey, you don't have enough light. You need to get more light to shoot this. And part of that problem is that it's not really capturing two individual eyes in a raw format. It is using computational photography to create those two eyes. It is captured as a single image. The goal really is that you can capture a video, take it into Final Cut, edit it all. It just keeps passing through that system and you don't have to think about two eyes. But
how
when you
I
push
get
it
to
out,
it?
It's going to have it. So, it's in your photos. I mean, if you open up the photo app.
Yeah, you have to go to settings settings, photos, and then choose. There's a sub setting that's basically like extended formats where you can choose like lots of, and you got to turn on that as a format. But then, as Alex said, it's just a button in video. There's no spatial video mode or something. There's just a button with a picture of a Vision Pro in a circle, and you tap it and it'll go automatically. It goes into landscape, automatically into 1080p 30, because that's the only mode that it'll shoot in. Because remember, it's cropping the ultra wide down to a wide to go to match the normal camera, and so it's losing resolution, which is why it's only 1080. And like there's a lot of I'm curious what Alex thought about it. I looked at some videos that I shot. There's a third party app that's in like test flight that lets you pull them apart and turn them into side by sides. And I watched them on my Quest.
Yeah.
The fact is it looks okay. It's not great. You really got to, the 3D stuff really needs to be very close to you.
You go to formats, you scroll down, and then there's spatial video for Apple Vision Pro. You have to turn that on.
And then it's just in your video. And
should I turn on ProRes too, Alex, by the way?
I would turn it on.
Yeah, okay.
This makes it an option.
Why not?
It won't matter for this because this is recording in an MPEG.
And then I saw a little Vision Pro thing. Yeah. I guess because I'm so close, I can't see it.
And you got to remember, you got to be a landscape.
Oh, okay.
Do it portrait. Okay. And then you should see a little.
There was a little Vision Pro thing.
Are you in video or in stills right now?
I'm in video. Should I be in stills?
No, should be in video.
Video. There it is. There it is. You saw it? Oh, boom. Now I'm move farther away. Well, yeah.
You need to. Yeah, and if you're just taking landscapes like off in the distance, don't use this feature because there's no real 3D you're going to see. You want things in the foreground and in the midground.
So if I do this of the I'll do this of the Festivus Bowl. Okay, now I'm
everything will matter between what's right in front of you. So
should I move around?
As we saw, you can move.
Yeah, or no? Is it better?
Just remember that it's fine. You can move around. This isn't 360 video. So when you end up viewing this on a Vision Pro, it's going to be on a square. No, but I'm just saying it's going to be
in
a window.
Yeah, you won't be in
because
a
360. It's not doing a 180. You know, like what you. Yeah.
And they fuzz the edges. There's like a border around the edges because when you get to the border, the video doesn't really work that well. So they're going to do a lot of things to calculate it out and make it, but it's going to be like a postcard kind of thing. It's not going to be an immersive thing.
Right.
But it's going to be great for, but it's going to be in there. I think that you're going to see some pretty interesting, I think eventually you'll be able to stream it from the phone. So you'll be able to like, someone could watch a 360 stream, in that 3D, area, 3D in 3D in vision, from the stream. In vision. If you're in vision, you'd be able to see it. I mean, and the idea that someday Apple could build a phone that would let you view it is not out of the question. Hydrogen did it. I don't know how many years ago. I mean, Red did it with the hydrogen.
Right.
It does degrade a lot of other quality issues around the phone. So I think it could be a little hard sell. But you know, the challenge that it has is that the interaxial distance, which it does not match our natural interocular distance. So it's got about one quarter of the parallax that you would normally have. And so it just means that as Jason said, you know, when you get the lenses, when you get the sensors at interocular, which is the same distance as our eyes, which is what the like Fuji cameras did and what
the Vision Pro will do when it captures video.
Exactly. When you get that, then it feels very natural to the amount of parallax or the amount of 3D-ish that you would. Now, a lot of times if we shoot bigger shows, we move the cameras further apart, and that creates a kind of a hyper, you know, but you can't have anything in the foreground because it'll cause you to cross your eyes. but I think that, you know, it's going to give you some fun footage. There are definitely things when you take things close up, it looks really, really cool. Most of my experience from the hydrogen shooting video and stills with it. When you get pretty close within a couple feet, it looks awesome. When you're shooting things like snow, it looks amazing. I mean, it just like snow looks, you know, things that change in distance a lot is really, really impressive. So there'll be things that people really, you'll start shooting stuff. And I think that people who have the 15 will shoot. I know I'm starting to shoot some of the spatial stuff just going, well, someday I may have this in a headset that I really care about or that I may show on my TV that is in 3D or whatever. You kind of like you're there, you shoot with your regular cameras and then you switch it to spatial and shoot a little spatial and then you go back.
That's important. That's a really important note, which is there are lots of things like you should experiment with this, right? But also do not say, oh, right, from now on, I've got to capture everything in this because it's very limited. You really need to have it be things that are sort of in that mid-ground 5 to 10 feet area. And honestly, in I don't know, 90% of scenarios, I would rather have a 4K video that's 2D than a 1080 video that's 3D.
And one of the things I think someone talked about, I don't remember whether it was either Apple talked about it or we talked about it on the show, was the idea of shooting a birthday cake. And of course, that's what I tried to do. My son turned 16 on the 24th of November. Aww. And I was, I'm going to get the birthday cake. And he's like, you don't have enough light. I was like, okay, never mind. Yeah. So I was like, got to do this outside. You know, if we're going to do it, you know, like it's got to be.
People don't understand.
Day.
Low light is just inside. You know, you're not getting good light inside generally. Yeah.
So it says
on this that it's spatial. Because I'm spatial. You can only do this on a 14 Pro. Is that right?
You have to have 15 Pro.
It says spatial, but it doesn't look any different. It won't look any different until I have the
left eye. And unless you separate those out using an app and put it on like a Quest, otherwise you'll have to wait until the Vision Pro.
But the nice thing about that is that it's going to go into an editing package that knows what it's looking at is generally going to just treat it like a, like you could cut a whole, like I went to the fair and here's all this 3D stuff that I showed you.
It's true.
And you don't have to think about like how to deal. I mean, for a lot of us, part of it is how do you manage all the stereo? Like you shoot all the stereo and then you're managing, you don't have to manage anything. You just put it in there. And I think that we haven't seen it yet, but I expect to see, well, I mean, obviously Final Cut and Motion have a lot of tools in there already for 3D. And so you'll see probably more in that area where those things link together with this video really well. So your ability to add graphics, to do the edit, do those things. And again, most likely we'll see this in Resolve and Premiere, but the advantage that Apple has by having Final Cut and Motion is that they own their own destiny. Like they can keep on building tools in to show what they can do with the, they know they're building a headset. They have to be able to build the content to the same level, and trying to get a big problem with Meta is the development pipeline. Like how do you get, you know, Apple is able to build all those tools and Meta did not, you know? And so we spent an enormous amount of our effort in the early Oculus days. We spent an enormous amount of effort just figuring out how to stitch everything together, just figuring out how to get everything working. And I think Apple is going to probably do this. They've got more runway. They have a lot more software and hardware dedicated to it. So it'll be interesting to see.
Also new, which is exciting, the action button actually now has the translate feature that they demonstrated. Has anybody used that? I mean,
I haven't.
Yeah. I guess I'll have to go somewhere soon.
But it does it in the Dynamic Island, so you can actually have it. You press the action button and say something into it, and then the Dynamic Island actually just expands with a translation of what it was, which is pretty cool. Cool idea.
Oh, that's neat. Here it is, translate. So I'll select translate. Okay, and that really over-designed UI for the action button. All right, now I have that. So I'll press and hold the action button. And now, as you said, it's doing it in the, but I have to download some languages first. So, okay, I'll download a few languages. Let's get Korean. Anyway, I won't do it in real time. But yeah, so before you travel, get your languages here. And English, I guess I have to download English just in case I want to translate back. I guess I do. So I'll get all of those. Both input and output languages. Yeah. Must be downloaded to enable offline translation. That's cool. It's doing that offline. So before you travel, that's a good thing to turn on. And then you can have conversations, right? Is that the idea? It's two way.
Yeah. Like, you can show it to somebody.
Where's the bathroom? Donde es el bathroom?
They've added
baños. See, it's already working. There are a bunch of Apple Music features. They've added an option to disable inline predictions. I've heard a lot of complaints about how crappy these inline predictions are getting. Sometimes it's even offering non-existent words. I don't know where it's getting that from, but I think that's when they moved it to on device, right? So you can turn that off. iMessage contact key verification. That's valuable for encryption. So you might want to turn that on and make sure nobody's doing a man in the middle and that the person you're talking to is actually the person you think you're talking to. Messages in iCloud syncing. They've renamed that. It also shows how much it's using, which is actually pretty handy. A bunch of stuff. What's new in Apple TV? This, they've put that sidebar in now, right?
Yeah.
So tell me about that.
There's a whole big, they moved the tabs off the top of the TV app, and now it's a sidebar. So you have to kind of like press the back button in order to display it, and then choose another tab and then click, and then it displays full screen. So what the advantage of it is, when you're in a tab, you're in it full screen. The disadvantage is this weird modal switcher instead of the old one where you could just sort of scroll up to the top and choose a different one. And they've also rolled a bunch of apps into it. So, you know, it feels like they're really trying to make it so that you can get to all of your video from that app without ever going back to the home screen. If you remember, the future of TV is apps, which is a thing that they said once. It seems like the future of TV, of Apple TV, is the TV app now. So if you want to get to like Disney Plus, you can literally scroll down in the menu in the main part of the TV app to Disney Plus and click it, and it'll just launch the app. So it's a weird, I don't know what they're doing there. I don't think I like it, but it's an interesting direction for them.
Yeah. They also removed the ability to buy stuff within the app itself. So now you have to buy stuff in the iTunes app separately.
No. It's the reverse. They've removed the iTunes apps, and now you buy all your stuff in the TV app. The TV app is the store, and the other apps are going away.
That's what Google's doing too, by the way. Google has finally gotten rid of the Play Store. Or what it was, TV and movies.
iTunes as a concept is sort of fading into the background. Yeah, and now it's like, if you want to rent or buy movies or TV, you actually just do it straight. You've been able to do it in the TV app for a little while now, but now they're just getting those apps out and saying, no, that's where you do it, the TV app. So you do a search for a movie you want to watch and you rent it or buy it. I just did this today with my pick that's coming up later. and then it comes, over, and that's it. So you don't need the iTunes. Yeah, iTunes as a concept is sort of like vanishing before our eyes.
Yeah, I try to buy music from the iTunes store. Every time I try to buy music, it takes me a while to find like how to actually do that.
It's the same problem. I'm just like, I just want to buy the song, and it's like this little like you got to find this. It literally feels like a little maze. Like I got to go over here, and then I got to click this thing, and I got to lift one foot, and then I've got to you know hop forward and jump over to the side.
There's a lot of new features. There's a book I can go on and on. Let me just try this translation thing. Which way to the bathrooms? Oh, and what?
No, ¿de dónde se va a los baños?
It's Spanish, Spain Spanish, not Mexican Spanish.
Castellano.
Yeah, listen.
¿De dónde se va a los baños?
Los baños. But cool. And I'm sure if I were in Mexico, they'd understand. They'd think I was kind of putting on airs, but they'd understand. Yeah. that's cool. That's really nice. I love that. I love it's the dynamic island. That's a great place to put it. And now I know where the bathrooms are. Let's see. Oh, gosh, there's so many stories, and we don't have any more time. So is there anything that you think is really important? You mentioned market cap over $3 trillion. If you want to use your phone's digital key to drive your car, look for the digital key logo, which uses RFID, not the insecure Bluetooth, to unlock your car, but that means you have to tap it on the door. I don't know if
NFC,
my, right? my I'm or getting a new
RFID
car in a month.
NFC. That's, I think it's NFC, right?
What did I say? NFT?
RFID. I think it's
NFT.
NFC.
Thank you.
Which is more secure than the RFID. That's why it matters.
Yeah, it's not going through the air. You actually have to have physical proximity. And that was a big problem with a lot of these things. Yeah, it's car key, right? And I think my new car has car key. I'm hoping. We'll see.
Sweet.
Sweet, man. Finally. I've been using the Ford app to
Bluetooth
get into my
out of here.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good. Or RFID for that matter.
Yeah, all Bluetooth keys to be replaced by NFC keys sometime soon, please.
Woohoo.
Yep. So much better.
Woohoo. Apple is now apparently offering incentive to musicians to goddamn use those high-end spatial audio things, because you're driving me crazy with your stereo stuff.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that Apple themselves make it harder because they spatialize a lot of the software already. I mean, 2D, they take stereo stuff and they've spatialized it. I wonder if they're going to pull back on that and go, hey, we're not going to, because right now what they do is they kind of reprocess
you it. You automatically get it. And maybe musicians aren't crazy about that, right?
No. It's just it's mostly because people haven't re-recorded. I mean, already a lot of the music, a lot of studios have spent a lot of time. If you've got all the stems or all the tracks, There's a lot of people out there remixing stuff for Atmos right now because of what Apple did. And Apple sweetening the pot by saying you might make more money, you might get more streams, just is going to keep on heating that. No, but it's really good for Apple. It's incredibly good for Dolby.
Dolby's loving it.
For Apple, yeah. For Apple, this is a rounding error. We'd like to have people, we want to, but what it does do is it separates the Apple platform from a lot of the other platforms because Android and Windows is kind of a dumpster fire when it comes to Vision and Atmos. And so Apple is like, what they're doing here is by pushing things towards Atmos and having more and more content over Atmos, they get to separate their platform from the problem is no matter what they do on Windows and Android, they're so fragmented. And Apple has invested, I think now 8 years into Atmos and Vision. So almost everything on the Apple platform will handle this and almost nothing on the Android and Windows will handle it. So Apple is really, this is not about money for Apple. It's about market separation. But for Dolby, it's a lot about money.
I don't know if Apple has announced this. It's just a rumor from Bloomberg. They say starting next year, the company plans to give added weighting to streams of songs that are mixed in Dolby Atmos. I hope that doesn't mean when I do a search for a song, it's going to give me songs that are Dolby Atmos over ones that aren't.
I think that what it means is that when your songs keep playing, so you play a song and it starts to play other songs after it.
Those will be Atmos.
It won't be the only wait. It's not like we're only going to play Atmos for you. But if there are two songs that the waiting for that next song is even or close, the Atmos one might be the next one you hear.
I'm not happy about that. Listeners will not necessarily have to play the Atmos version for the artist to get the extra money, just that the extra money comes because the artists have offered it in that format. So it's encouraging it. Atmos. I no longer can tell the difference. So
I can hear it.
Yeah, I know you can't, but I don't. I mean, I guess if I really pay attention, I can hear it. I don't think at first I thought, this is like, and they have pitched it as this is like going from mono to stereo. I don't think it's that big a jump. Do you still?
Oh, see, to me, it's more of a jump than from mono to stereo because the problem is that you can't, it's just a lot less muddy. So the thing is that when you start putting all the instruments, you start filling in those spaces, your mind is able to manage that. And the big thing that happens when people are really, and right now we're not designing, we're basically doing stereo and then we kind of make it a little wider. When you work with a really good Atmos mix, what happens is that Atmos mix builds a kind of a theater in your mind that you're listening to and it feels bigger. And what it'll do is it'll make what's coming right down that center track even more present. Because your mind has kind of built up this space that it sits inside of that makes it more present than what it, so it's actually the singing that actually sounds the best when done correctly. The problem is that a lot of people will build what we call a phantom center with the right and left channel. Then you don't get some of that benefit. So when it's mixed properly down that center track and you use use that space, you end up in it feels much bigger. And I think
I'll take your word for it.
You're hearing, the problem is that a lot of this always comes down to the content, is that a lot of the content and a lot of the mixes are kind of muddy. And so you don't hear it. When you hear it done really well, it makes a big difference.
iPhone 17, which is 2 years off, will get TSMC's 2-nanometer chips. Okay, great. It's the end of E3. The ESA finally admitted it after announcing it and canceling it 2 years in a row. Now they finally said, yeah, we're going to skip the announcing part. It's canceled. The Apple executive who invented the iPhone screen and Touch ID, Steve Hotelling, is leaving. He was top deputy.
Retiring.
Well, he's going to have more time with his money.
He's got to have a lot of money. He's doing okay.
Yeah. So he was a direct report to Johnny Cerugi.
I feel like that's going to be a story of the next 10 years at Apple too, next 5 years.
They're aging out.
A lot of the people who were really key in bringing the iPhone to bear, the ones who are still there, they're all going to cash out, right? Like they're all going to leave. It's not going to all happen at once, but like anybody who was at Apple 15 years ago and had stock options probably doesn't need to work anymore unless they have like a gambling problem. I don't know. or many, many, many different divorced spouses. Anyway,
Apple employee number 17.
Right. And like it's a victim of your own success that some of those people are not driven by money, but also Apple is a hard place to work is the impression I get. And you have to work real hard. And at some point you probably want to step off the treadmill.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I know that feeling.
Go to the Cabo house, right? Time to go to the beach house.
This is a happy story. It's a different story when like they got hired away by somebody,
right?
Which is like, oh,
no, Steve dear, deserves that's a problem. Deserves some time at the Los Cabos retreat.
Yeah.
Picks of the week, gentlemen, prepare them because that's what's next on Mac Break Weekly. Our show today brought to you by Wix. Oh, web agencies, you're gonna like this one. Let me correct that. You're going to love this one. Let me tell you about Wix Studio, the platform that gives agencies total creative freedom to deliver complex client sites and still smash deadlines. Seems impossible, right? Well, first, let's start with the advanced design capabilities. With Wix Studio, you can build unique layouts with a revolutionary grid experience. Watch as elements scale proportionally by default. It's kind of magical. No-code animation adds sparks of delight, while custom CSS gives you total design control. But it doesn't stop there. You'll be bringing ambitious client projects to life in any industry using a fully integrated suite of business solutions, e-commerce, events, bookings. It's all in there. But that's not all. You can extend the capabilities even further with hundreds of APIs and integrations. And you know what else? The workflows just make sense. There's the built-in AI tools, the centralized workspace, the on-canvas collaboration, the reuse of assets across sites, and the seamless client handover. You're going to love it. Find out more at wix.com/studio. Check it out, the new Wix Studio, wix.com/studio. We thank them so much for supporting Mac Break Weekly. I rarely do this because my wallet is already groaning under the burden, but let's start with Alex Lindsay's pick of the week.
It's free.
It's free.
It's free for this
I
one.
I love you.
So I am recommending graymatter.show, and because this week, Jason Snell was our guest. Yay. It just released it this morning. Yay. And what a great conversation. It was just a really, I mean, I know Jason's here, so Jason, just close your ears.
Don't tell me.
For a second. Yeah. One of our best episodes. Like just a really, really good. I mean, it was just a really, I don't know how it felt on your end, Jason, but it felt like a really.
I think this Michael Krasny kid really has a future.
He's got a future. Yeah. And Jason's, I think it's hard to tell, but Jason's really smart. And
take someone good at interviewing and matches up with someone who knows something.
The dog Jason's, on a keyboard on the internet. I don't know what I'm doing.
Jason's been around and he's really sharp and has great insights. So I'm not surprised. I can't wait to hear it.
And Michael Krasny is an outside our domain kind of interviewer. Yeah. So
he's curious,
right? Because he has questions that are like, or like, what about this AI stuff? And I'm like, oh, okay, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
It's not really my top area, but yeah, let's do it. Yeah, that was a wild kind of out of body experience to talk to somebody who is a legend in radio in the Bay Area. And he was just talking to me. I mean, before we got started, he was like, we were talking about Star Trek. It was weird. It was actually a really good kind of icebreaker where he's like, I interviewed Gene Roddenberry. And
I bet he's really good at that kind of thing. Yeah, just kind of
I think so.
Warming you up before the show.
I think he's good at it. I think he is.
Also featuring
Alex.
Advice for new and aspiring journalists from an editor-in-chief for many years, a longtime journalist. So that sounds like a good episode. It's a graymatter.show episode
with an E.
62, Jason Snell.
And all of them, I think that what's really interesting is all three of you have been on, and all of them are some of our top shows. You know, it's been really, I think that there's some kind of matchup between what we're talking about and his interviewing style have been really, really good. So
did we beat Geraldo? Did we get more downloads than Geraldo? So,
I will say that, no, you did actually.
Oh, good.
The funny thing is that the Geraldo one is still like, it's the best interview of him I've ever heard.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a much more complex person in that interview than I've ever assumed he was watching.
That's because Krasny's good. Krasny knows what he's doing. Amber Mack is an earlier interview. But the list of people he's interviewed are Ken Burns, I mean, it's just mind-boggling.
When,
some
when
of the best
Ken Burns
people.
Is excited to be on the show,
yeah,
like they were,
yeah,
they were. They,
that's so cool.
Interviewed him quite a few times. It's you know you're
yeah.
Getting
that's so cool. Graymatter.show. See, it didn't cost you a thing. Look, there's Andy, Andrew Anatko, pick o' the week. Muted. You're muted. Unmuted.
Mine is
yes.
Mine is always a good pick around this time of year, a Charlie Brown Christmas. And good news is that Apple has decided to do something very nice they didn't have to do, which is to make it absolutely free, no subscription required this weekend. So if you just download the Apple TV Plus app on December 16th and 17th, which is Saturday and Sunday, I believe, this weekend, you can watch it without any subscription whatsoever, which, again, I think it was they don't have to do it. It's just a really nice thing to do, given how this is iconic and parents want to share this with their kids.
Yes.
Just like their parents wanted to share it with them. They didn't have to do this. It's made a little bit more difficult because they also, when they got exclusivity on all the Charlie Brown specials, they also removed them digitally from like every other app store, media store. So the only place to get it is on DVD, and a lot of houses don't even have DVD players anymore. So the gold standard would have been to air it on PBS, which is what they did the first time. But I'm sure there were going to be problems getting clearances for that, even if they decided to make that big of a gesture. But yeah, this is great. It's in high definition. It's almost off-putting watching it on a 4K TV if you are of a certain age, because there needs to be interlace and a little bit of snow.
Wow.
the ability to see old animation in 4K, you can actually see the shadows between the cell drawings and the background. It's a trip, man.
Wow.
But yeah, this thing completely holds up. It's quite wonderful. And again, thank you, Apple, for making this move.
Yeah, that's really great. I mean, I wish Apple would send each and every one of us in the entire nation our own UHD DVD copy. But failing that, I think at least they're putting it on. Yep. It is number one, by the way, on their holiday charts. Charlie Brown Christmas.
It's kicking the butt of the It's Arbor Day Charlie Brown.
as it should.
Quite right.
As it should. Jason, this is
that
Jason. This is not on your.
Everybody acknowledges it.
This is not at the bottom of your list of Charlie Brown shows.
Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving one's bad. This one's a good one.
This one's at the top. Tippity top.
Of the chart.
I can't play the music.
Dance.
But I think if I hum it.
Right. We all know.
It won't. Nobody will take it down. I play Vince Guaraldi all year long. Vince Guaraldi is awesome.
That's my favorite Christmas album. Oh, is just that music.
It's the best.
That.
Just listen to it on repeat.
Yeah, that's two free picks of the week, by the way.
Vince Guaraldi.
I'm going to make you pay.
Yeah.
I'm going to make you pay. Well, no, it was like Apple showing it free. Alex has got a free podcast. I'm going to make you pay because... you know, James Cameron, maker of some of the most profitable movies of all time. But for my money, his best movie has not been available in 4K HDR until yesterday, I think. I mean, basically right now, which is The Abyss from 1989. I love this movie. It's available. I think you get the special edition, which is my preferred edition because he had to cut a lot of stuff out to get it to a shorter runtime. And I'll just say that I remember this movie, the special edition, being incredibly long. By modern standards, it's not a long movie at all.
No. Go ahead and watch Killers of the Flower Moon 3.5 exactly. hours later.
Exactly. So now it's Abyss special edition. It's wonderful. Restores a lot of good character bits. The ending makes more sense. If you are a purist and want it on disc, it is coming out on a UHD release in the spring. But I'll tell you, I have wanted to talk about this movie on my podcast, The Incomparable, for 700 episodes now. and it's been my white whale in a way because it was not really available. And the special edition, especially, not really available in anything but DVD for the longest time. Yeah, not even HD, just DVD. And that's not good enough. And they did a 4K restoration. My understanding is they did it several years ago, but Jim had to sign off on it. And finally, after making a million avatars or whatever he did sign off on it. It is coming out on disc, but you can just also buy the 4K on your on Apple's, not on iTunes because it's gone, but like in the TV app or on Amazon or wherever else videos are sold on the internet. 4K version HDR. Can't wait to watch it. This is $20 or wait for the disc.
I'll buy it. This is important in CGI history too, as I remember, Alex.
Yep. It's the first CG composite.
Yeah. The so water the water weenie that comes out of the water is a, water is a experimental CGI thingy.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, so just say it's so experimental that I didn't notice until I read about this in CineFX or something that he designed the shot so that he could remove it. That if it completely failed, he could get rid of it. In an interview he just gave last week with Variety, he said that there was another like effect shot with the finale shot, which is what Jason was referring to. It was actually tested. And they just could not get the effects to work. And also when they tested it in with an audience, it just didn't work. So we got rid of it. So this is this is a 1992 restoration, which they put it all back together. And I agree with Jason. It is the best movie that James Cameron has made in a catalog of really great movies. And furthermore, there is one scene that I don't want to spoil, but Jason knows very well what I'm talking about, that I think is one of the greatest scenes
I just got chills, Andy. I agree. I think that there is one particular scene in this movie that is one of the best scenes ever made on film.
Really?
It is shocking.
Oh, I'll be watching it this week, and then I'll see if I
hear myself saying, I wish I could come up with this. Oh. Yes, it's amazing.
Okay, so I'll be looking for that. Yeah. Wow, great pick. Thank you.
Good movie.
And thank you all for being here. Jason Snell is at sixcolors.com. That's where you can read.
Yes, I am.
Him and the Dan Morin and all the other stuff and how to stop mail logs from eating your disk space and
all sorts of fun stuff in there. We have John Moltz. He's funny. He writes a funny column for us at the end of the week.
I love Moltz.
We got lots of stuff going on there. So check it out and then more if you become a member. But you know we all have our memberships, don't we? But anyway, a lot of it's free, so you can check it out.
There is also, of course, a special page dedicated to Jason's 1,400 different podcasts.
Many different podcasts.
Sixcolors.com/Jason. And look at them all. You busy, busy guy.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah. Thank you, Jason. I appreciate you filling in for me when I was off getting my brain fixed, by the way.
Of course.
Thank you. I appreciate
happy.
It. Happy. Yeah. Mr. Andy Anatko, GBH in your future?
Yes, Thursday, 12:30, go to WGBHnews.org to listen to it live or later, or listen to the last one I did a couple weeks ago.
Very nice. Anything to tell us about Anatko.com?
I'm aiming to get it out before the Vision Pro. Let's put it that way.
I love it. Sometime early next year.
Yeah. And now I'm disappointed that you're about training of Apple Store employees. Oh damn! I guess I'm going to be working on Christmas, aren't I?
Thank you, Andrew and Alex Lindsay. Of course, GrayMatter.show, the show he produces with Michael Krasny. But day in, day out at OfficeHours.global, where you can really find out what's going on in the world of production. And if you want to hire this cat, 090.media.
Yeah, we had a great day today. This morning we had Alex Goldner, who builds a lot of the lower thirds and stuff like that for some of the web assets for the BBC.
Oh, wow.
And he was breaking down how he builds these in Motion and how you build the integration between Motion and Final Cut so that you can build all the tools that you want and everything from, lots of stuff that I didn't even know existed. And like, I've been using Motion since version one and he was showing stuff and I was like, I was today's years old when I knew that. So he was kind of building that integration there. It's pretty slick.
Lots of cool
stuff.
So
I would definitely check it out.
Blackmagic camera app show. There's a show.
We spent a whole show last week talking about the Blackmagic camera app. And it's, it really is pretty groundbreaking. I mean, the level of sophistication, especially in a free app, is kind of amazing. So we spent a fair bit of time talking
about it. I'll have to watch that so I can use it properly. OfficeHours.global. That's the website. Find out more. We do Mac Break Weekly Tuesdays, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1900 UTC. We do stream all our shows as we produce them on YouTube, which is, of course, youtube.com/twit. And if you subscribe that way, you'll get a little notification when we are going to go live. We go live during the show so you can watch it. If you're watching live, join us in the club. The Club Twit Discord is a great place to hang. I spend a lot of time in there. In fact, you know, many of us are doing the Advent of Code, and there's a nice Advent of Code section in there. We talk about all kinds of geeky stuff. So if you are into geek stuff, if you're into our shows, the Discord's great. There's only one catch. You got to be a member of Club Twit. What? You're not a member? How could that possibly be? We'd love to have you as a member. Here's the deal. $7 a month. You do get the Discord, but you also get access to all of our shows ad-free. Now, there was somebody in our Twit forums at twit.community who said, but I still want the ads. Let me tell you, you can still join the club and listen to the ad-supported versions of the shows. We're not stopping you from doing that. We just offer ad-free versions if that's your choice. You get access to the Discord content we don't put out in public, like Hands on Macintosh with Micah Sargent. But the most important thing to understand is that $7 a month is life or death at this point for us. We're going to put up our goals for 2024. And honestly, if Twit's to be here in 2025, we need to double the size of the club. Only about 1% of you are members. We'd love to get that to, well, at least 2%, maybe 5%. That would really put us on a good financial footing. It's going to be up to you. Twit.tv/ClubTwit if you're not already a member. And thanks in advance. After the fact, even non-club members can listen to the show. You just go to twit.tv/MBW. That's the website. You can also, there's a YouTube channel dedicated to MacBreak Weekly with even more ads if you like the ads. And then there, because YouTube ads their own. And then there's, of course, the best way to listen, which is to get a podcast client. We like Pocket Casts, but Apple Podcasts or whatever you prefer. I think Google just killed their podcast app, and I think Apple's podcast is not long for this world, but Pocket Casts is great, and we recommend it.
Apple Podcasts isn't going anywhere. They keep updating it.
Why did I think that they were making changes in the
they keep adding new features to so they've got actual real developers on.
Yeah, they're all in on podcasting. Well, that's good. I like that. So you can use that if you want. But whatever you like, do subscribe, because that way you'll get the show the minute it's available on a Tuesday afternoon. Thanks to John Ashley, our technical director. Who edits the show these days? Mr. John Ashley, our technical director and editor, edits the show. And who produces the show? John Ashley, editor and director. John Ashley, the producer, editor, and technical director of the show. And thanks also to John Slonina, the other John, who's our studio manager, and Burke McQuinn, who keep the things working, of course, to our entire team. It's been a little rough this holiday season for Twit. We're really doing our best to get everything together and keep it going in 2024 and onward. And your help will help a lot. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time. But I am sad to say, time to get back to work, because break time is over. See you next time. Episode 900. Bye-bye. Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club Twit. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club Twit Discord, a great clubhouse for Twit listeners. And finally, the Twit Plus feed with shows like Stacy's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, and more. Go to twit.tv/ClubTwit. And thanks for your support.